Good afternoon, everybody.
Well, thank you. That was very quick. Good afternoon again. My name is Jim Chase. I'm the director of the PG&E Pacific Energy Center here in San Francisco. I hope some of you have been there. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hey, we do our best. I'd like to welcome everybody, and I'd especially like to welcome mayors and dignitaries here today who are visiting from all around the world. Just a few things. I won't take very much of your time because you've got an excellent presentation coming up today, but there are a few logistics here. Some of you may already know this, but in order to go to the restroom here, we have to do a little bit of hand stamping. So if you go out the back door to the right here, someone will stamp your hand, then you can go down to the hall to the restroom. This can be very important. Presentations will end at approximately 4:15, and there will be about 45 minutes for questions. So if you could all wait until 4:15 for your questions, we'd much appreciate that we can get through things a little bit easier. And we will try to end right on time at about 5 o'clock, and then at 5 o'clock there will also be a book signing in the back foyer here in the back of the auditorium. As I said, I wasn't going to say very much today, but I do have to applaud something, and it is a bit of myself. This is the 30th year that I've been working in energy efficiency. 25 of those years have been here at PG&E. And I have to say that I think that there is progress. You notice the hesitation. I think there's progress, right? No, there is progress, and there are a couple of examples of that progress in particular, and that is that, for all of those of you who don't know, California has the lowest per capita energy use in the United States. Hey, that's great. By the way, it's about half of that of Texas. And the other thing I think that is very, very encouraging and is germane to today's presentations is that how many of you saw the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday? You don't have to hiss. There was something very interesting on the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and that is that for the first time, developers are thinking that brownfield developments are more profitable and practical than greenfield developments. Now, that is a change. And the fact that it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, that's a change. So I think we can say that we have made some progress in convincing others that, in fact, our efforts are really worthwhile. So right now I would like to turn this presentation now and the introductions over to Mark Palmer, who is from the SF Environment Department. Mark himself, we can applaud him as well, also has 30 years nearly in sustainable development activities. Mark.
Thank you very much, Jim. Mayors and delegates and esteemed guests, welcome to World Environment Day 2005. It's my great pleasure as a representative of San Francisco's Department of the Environment to welcome you all to this Green Building keynote address. We are honored to have you in our presence. My name is Mark Palmer. I'm the Green Building Coordinator in San Francisco's Department of the Environment. I'd like to acknowledge our other sponsors here today, Jim Chase with PG&E's Pacific Energy Center. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this facility, it's one of the premier energy and green building training centers here in California. We're very lucky to have this facility and encourage all of you to take advantage of that whenever possible. Also, the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco Department of the Environment, the Environmental Protection Agency, Bay Area Build It Green, StopWaste.org, Building Green, and our platinum sponsor is Christy Graham with the Healthy Home Plans, who's also the production manager for West Coast Green, a new San Francisco-based green building expo and convention to be held here in March of 2006, so keep your eyes open for that. We are delighted to have two very different guests sharing the stage for the first time today. I will now introduce both speakers, so I won't have to get up here again. And Sarah will be the first one to present. I'm not sure exactly how to introduce Andres Duany. I think I'm not going to try to tell you things that you may already know or that are written in the detailed biography in your program notes. I was a child growing up in the 50s, and I grew up in the heyday of suburbia. Much as Andres did in that era, and I saw when my parents were building a home, in a typical American subdivision, how they were knocking down 300-year-old oak trees and grading pristine Ohio farm and agricultural land to make all the contours flat and put highways through and the residential on one side and the commercial and shopping on the other side. And, you know, it's a new era today when we're really thinking of how to order our built environment and how to construct the things so that it gives a meaning to our place. My best friend growing up lived outside the back door. Well, our backyard's adjoined, but we've lived on opposing cul-de-sacs. And it took me, you know, 20 seconds to get over to his house on foot. But if I wanted to drive to his house, it was about a mile and a half drive. So that's the kind of obstacle that we're faced with in trying to create walkable communities, pedestrian-oriented communities. When I heard in the 80s of Andre's work in the new urbanism and creating a new towns with an actual town center, with the radial transportation networks and walkable towns, and remembering that humans are pedestrian animals and we didn't come into this earth with a car strapped to our back or a steering wheel glued to our hands. And it's about creating a sense of place, and I think that's actually where the common thread is between our two speakers here today. A lot of Andres' work is known as in greenfield development. However, a great deal of his work is also concentrated on inner city work. So there's a lot of infill and not necessarily working with a new town development per se, but working within the inner cities as well. So instead of having places that are defined by automobiles, I think that we're looking at a new paradigm today. And what Andres does for the town, Sarah does for the home. I first met Sarah in the year 2000 in Denver at the EBA conference. EBA stands for Energy and Environmental Building Association, where she was the keynote speaker at the time. And as a longtime builder, I've had a lot of experience trying to look at plans on paper and imagine what they're going to look like in real life when they're actually completed and trying to transfer that information to clients. And that's oftentimes the hard part. And what I realized after hearing Sarah talk is that she not only can see in her mind's eye what these places look like and is able to communicate that to her clients, but also what these spaces feel like. And I think that's another very important new dimension of creating place. And I'd have to say that she concentrates more on the psychology of space and, if you will, maybe even the spirit in architecture. And I really believe that Sarah's spaces that she creates are truly sacred, where each square inch has not only a function and a purpose, but a meaning too. So how can we bring permanence and a sense of meaning to our placemaking? I think we'll hear some intriguing and challenging thoughts today. First, Sarah Sosenka. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here. I like talking to sustainability and green crowds more than any other because you get 99% of what I'm talking about already, so we can take it to a different level. And I think when Mark heard me at EBA those few years ago, I remember that audience. It was just, when you're a speaker, the audience and you create this incredible space together, and that's what we're going to do today. So I'm going to give you essentially the general ideas that I talk about to my audiences of general public or all architects or all builders, but I'm going to intersperse it with what I'm trying to do so that you can understand the message behind the message, which I think is really what I suspect most of the people in this room are about. Before I start, could I get a sense of who is here? Could I, first of all, see a show of hands for how many architects are in the audience? So we've got maybe, 5-6%. How many builders? All stripes. That's maybe 2-3%. How many, green consultants of one stripe or another? maybe another 5-6%, something like that. How many mayors and delegates? Couple? We won't put a percentage on that. And how many that I haven't covered in those topics, in those characteristics? So lots and lots of you. All right, fantastic. Well, I'm going to give you just a little bit of background about how I came to write these books in the first place. I moved from England, from a little village of 1,000 people, to Los Angeles when I was 14 years old. My high school was 3 times the size of my village. And talk about culture shock. We sort of had the same language, but that was about it. I spent a long time trying to practice how to say hi instead of hello, you know, which was my normal way. It would come out, hi! And I felt terribly embarrassed, and I was, you know, I felt like I was speaking this foreign language. Everything about Los Angeles was alien, except that the footprints of our houses were somewhat similar. Everybody had the formal living room, the formal dining room, and in my growing up, we had used those rooms every day for every meal. So in my dining room at my house in Palos Verdes in Los Angeles, we sat down for a meal for every mealtime in the formal space. So it was really a novelty to look at how my friends in Los Angeles were using their houses and realize they don't live the way that I do. They've got this, you know, literally the plastic covers at that time. This was the early 70s on the furniture, and apparently nobody ever sat in those spaces. And meantime, everyone was hanging out in the kitchen and the informal eating area, which was usually a miserable space, and that was their life. That was where they spent 90% of their waking hours in the house. And it just seemed like something was terribly missing. And then when I walked around the neighborhoods, the same thing was true. There was no there. You couldn't find places to congregate. And as a teenager, that was incredibly frustrating. You had to basically be moving or you were loitering. And there was no place to go except around the block. So, you know, we would walk. And there was just something terribly missing. And having come from a village where there was really the opposite of that experience, it seemed to me that I knew what I wanted to do with my life at that early age. And so I started to pursue an interest in what came to, I realized after a while, was architecture. Went to architecture school and then started an architecture firm serving a residential clientele. And what I can tell you is that I discovered very quickly there was something terribly wrong with how we're building and even thinking about houses in this country. When people would come into my office, they would start by telling me how many square feet they wanted. And 99% of the time, the number of square feet they were telling me they wanted didn't correlate in any way, shape, or form with their budget. So architects are in this very awkward position. From the first moment they're talking to a client, they're telling them, well, you can't do it. And that's not a very good way to get a customer. You know, it doesn't go over well. So we gradually tried to help people figure out what they really wanted. And that required us to take them through a thought process about a very different way of conceiving what home really is. And so we first of all had to help them see that the size of the house, what has come to be bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of square footage from 1950s with an average floor area of about 1,000 square feet to the year 2000 where it's 2,200. I was just told the average house in California now is 2,400 square feet. And we all know that the numbers are also skewed by the mega houses that are being built that were, you know, really a new phenomenon in the middle to late 80s. So there's something that is out of whack. And what I started to realize was that people were making more money, wanted to sort of show what they had done in the world, and the answer is a bigger house. But we do this unconsciously. We don't stop and think about, is that what I really want? Is that going to feel more the way that I want it to feel? So when I drove through the suburbs of Des Moines, Iowa, and saw houses like this, now Des Moines to me is like, you know, the middle of the country, not big city, And there were large, large houses going up in the suburbs of Des Moines. And I just felt this urge to write down what I know. I just knew that somebody had to articulate that, is this what you really want? Is this what home is all about? And as I went into these houses, as I suspect many of us have had the experience, you find that the formal spaces, the formal living room, the formal dining room, the entryway, are uninhabited. They are literally empty. They typically, very often, don't even have any furniture, because that's not where the living happens. It should be called the no-living room. And yet, you know, here's the family room and the kitchen, and that's where most of the living happened. And nobody stops and thinks, you know, is there something wrong with this picture? And I've talked to so many couples that, you know, they have me over to their house, and they want to do something to make it feel more friendly, but they don't realize that because they're not actually utilizing half the house, that that's part of what's making it not feel very friendly. It's like you've got an alien living in your home, you know, that extra half of the square footage. So there's something amiss. And when I lived in Minneapolis and St. Paul up until 1999, I used to give a lecture at the Home and Garden Show each year. And I talked about, I hadn't named it the not-so-big house yet, but I talked about smaller, better-designed houses. And a couple came up to me after I'd given one of these talks, and the woman was in tears. She had just built, at that time, a $500,000 house. Today, probably in California, it'd probably be at least $1 million, maybe a little bit more. And they were so disenchanted with the house that they had built that they couldn't bring themselves to buy furniture. Well, I asked, you know, what happened? How did that occur? And they had found a lot that they liked. The lot was associated with a builder. The builder had a set of 14 or 15 home plans that he typically used. And they had picked the plan based on the spatial adjacencies. And they knew that they wanted a family room. They'd been living in a small South Minneapolis house that didn't have a kid space, a place that was kid-friendly. They wanted a place that they could have a TV that was close to the kitchen, etc. This was the room that they built that was supposedly this family room. And anybody in this audience will tell you that that space is going to be an acoustical nightmare if you put a TV into it, let alone the ceiling height alone is not friendly. It doesn't encourage intimacy. It doesn't encourage socializing. So there was, from the get-go, they had made a huge mistake. But by the time they realized what was happening during construction, they couldn't get changes made. They were too far along in the process. And so, to make a long story short, I came into their lives, they sold that house, and I designed for them a new one, which I will show you at the end of this talk to give you a sense of what a not-so-big house might really be about. And then, on a less grand scale, we still have all over this country houses that are probably bigger than most of us in this audience would go for, but not the mega houses. But these are two-dimensional homes. Look at this picture. And you can see that somebody designed, sort of, the front facade, but the sides are all vinyl siding. And, you know, this one's even an exception because it at least has windows in the side. Most people are so afraid of seeing their neighbors that there's no windows in the sides either. So we have this two-dimensional view of the world. And if you move away from the front face, you immediately see that it's all paper thin. And that's a real metaphor for a lot of what's happening in society today. So there's something missing. And what's amazing is that most general public audiences don't realize it. I tell people ahead of time, I'm sorry, but what you're going to see today is going to disillusion you from 99% of what's being built today in suburbia. And you know, people write to me all the time saying, oh, yeah, I get it. You know, this is not a pretty picture. In Minnesota, you see the little slice of brick facade that's on the stepped back section that's given a little slice of brick. That's vinyl, too, in Minnesota, because that doesn't show up on the front elevation of a set of blueprints. And so that's the side, so that's vinyl. And it's just amazing how we don't even see this stuff, and yet it's everywhere. And it's so much less than what could be. And then you have houses that are obviously reinterpretations of a house that at one point might have been okay. look at the slice of the chunk of roof that's been taken out of this house. In the original version, there was almost certainly an upper deck or a porch or maybe a larger bedroom, and somebody had decided some iteration back that they didn't need that. And so what happens? We just carve the house like a loaf of bread and take that piece away, and we end up with this monstrosity of a corner that is ridiculous in shape and form. There's no beauty there. And then you're also looking at the front face of somebody else's house. There's no thought given to community, to connection, interconnection. And this is the state of most of what happens in suburbia today. I now live in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is really a forest of pine trees. And every time there's a new development, this is what happens. The pine trees get mowed down. There's nothing saved, and they start from scratch. So the very quality that could have made this community a lovely place is removed. And then you start, and you do the standard. I heard a wonderful phrase at lunch today, cul-de-sacs as dead worms, you know, sort of lying across the landscape. And you just have this sort of amorphous nowhere land that I spent my time in Los Angeles. So something needs to be done. Now, I'm going to tell you another story just to sort of set the stage for the condition of the world today. I have a very active website, notsobighouse.com. And one of the Kit Seaborg, who's actually in the audience here today, my web architect, noticed that there was a sudden spike in the number of people that were visiting the website. And we wanted to figure out what the heck happened. And she did some sleuthing and found out that a guy had a blog, a weblog, and he had posted these pictures on his weblog. This was his neighborhood. This was the house across the street from him. This is what happened to that house, and this is what went up. Then there was another one, just two doors down. That was the original house, and that's what went up. And then there was another one. And then there was another one. And he decided, I have got to take things into my own hands. My neighbors need to read The Not So Big House. And so he put copies of my books on all of his neighbors' doorsteps and and told them to read it. And of course, not only did his neighbors read it, but then all these people who had read his blog got really excited, and suddenly I had all this traffic on my website. But people are so horrified. Imagine, this is a lovely inner ring suburb. This is happening across the country. And we look at this and we go, how could they do this? But the reality is that the people that are buying these older houses are buying them because they like the neighborhood. And they don't know that there are other options than going to a standard home plans book and finding a starter castle to build. That's what we do. And so that's what happens. And one of the things when I'm talking to my architectural colleagues, I implore them to understand that we can't, as a profession, turn our noses up in the air and walk in the other direction. It's incumbent upon us to put other solutions and alternatives into the marketplace, because we have the ability to design other options. And so one of the things that Christy Graham and I are right now doing is trying to get more architecturally designed home plans into the market through healthyhomeplans.com to really help move the marketplace to a better alternative. But there's so much that we need to do. And the fact that people don't even stop and wonder, is this a good solution, is pretty terrifying. They just do it on automatic. And we can be as incensed as we like, but unless we really help to put some alternatives out there, it ain't going to happen. The other thing I tell my architectural colleagues is that we, as a profession, did ourselves a terrible disservice back in the probably late 20s, early 30s. We got really excited by what architects call the international style, which is wonderful. It's a beautiful style. It's got some elegance, etc. But to most people who are not trained in architecture, it doesn't look like home. It doesn't have any of the emblems that remind them that this is residential. So this is a glass house, and most people, although they might say, God, that's really interesting art, they're not going to decide to move in. So they look at this, they go, that's interesting art, now who do I go to build me a house? And they don't think of an architect as an option. So we kind of separated ourselves from the public that needs our help. And so one of the things I'm trying to do with my books is use relatively conventional imagery, which to architects can be rather boring because it's, you know, they might think it's too traditional. But I'm doing it very consciously and very intentionally because it's only through linking to images that people can relate to that we can start to teach them about the qualities and characters of architecture that will make a house into home. And then we're on the platform where we can start to introduce new models, new ideas. But first of all, we really have to be able to explain what good design is all about. And perhaps most important of all is we need to understand that houses and any building needs to be proportioned to our human scale. These houses that we're building in the suburbs right now are suitable for Brobdingnagians, for those of you that know Gulliver's Travels. They are enormous, and now the furniture is even enormous because it's got to fill the space, and so my husband, who is shorter than I am, complains frequently that he can't even buy a chair anymore that he can sit in comfortably because everything is oversized, and oversized is supposed to be good. So there's something majorly amiss, and one of the things I'm really trying to do is to help introduce a whole set of ideas. So what you're going to see over the next 40 minutes or so is really an introduction to the ideas behind the not-so-big house. And I want to tell you ahead of time, what I'm describing is not about small houses. Not-so-big means about a third smaller than you thought you needed, but just as expensive. So just so that you get the image, I'm trying to get people to say, okay, I don't need that much square footage, but in order to get the quality and character and sustainability of design that I'm looking for, I have to spend those dollars differently. And that's what this is all about. So for some of us in this audience, we might be perfectly happy in 600-800 square feet. There are others, many in our population, who would have a very hard time moving into less than 3,000 square feet. I've taken it upon myself not to make a value judgment about whether that's right or wrong. I'm trying to avoid the judgment side. I'm just trying to give them another option that's going to make a house that will be wonderful for them today, but will also last for 300 years, so that it's something that is going to be a good custodian of the resources of our planet, and understand that all of us make our own decisions in how we go about that. So I named this book Not So Big as opposed to Small because I wanted to be able to get to the people that at the time this came out in 1998 were building 7,000-8,000 square foot houses. Nobody in that marketplace is going to buy a book called The Small House Book, but they might buy a book called The Not So Big House. And I actually got to practice what I preach as I was writing this book. A couple who were building a very large house and had been advised by one of their friends that they might want to have somebody that knew what they were doing with design take a look at it. And I became their architect, and I helped them to decrease the house they were building by half. It's still the largest house I've ever designed, and it probably would be an embarrassment to most of us to even imagine. It was about 7,500 square feet by the time I finished with it. But it's designed so that it's a very good, very energy efficient home, and it's designed so that at some time in the future it'll probably become a retreat center or a lodge. Or it's designed with that thought in mind. I didn't tell my client that, but we have to. We have to think about it that way. So for all of those of you, we've all been with people like that. You've got to figure out a way to see into the future, not just what am I doing today, but what is this going to be a few years from now, and help make something beautiful. If you look at the great houses from Wright, from all of the great residential architects, many of them were large. And we learn from those today. So rather than saying they're bad, I think it's more helpful to figure out a way to make them something that's going to be a good teacher in the future. Anyway, so when I was started to write The Not So Big House, I knew I needed an example of what I was describing. And so I designed a house for myself that, amusingly enough, was actually twice the size of the house I had been living in. I had been living in a house of about 1,000 square feet, and this one was 2,400 by the time I finished. But I wanted to build in all of the concepts that I was describing and have them be palatable enough to the American public that they would be able to get it. And so on the main level, there's 940 square feet, and this is a living room, dining room, and kitchen, and a kitchen, eating area, and family room, and they're all the same space. So I wanted to show that you don't have to have the formal spaces and the informal spaces be different. Now, in California, this is not news. You've been doing this for a long time, but most of the rest of the country is not there yet. When I even talk about removing the formal dining room in Boston or anywhere in Massachusetts, forget it. It's a lost battle. They want their dining room, even though they only use it once a year. So I'm just trying to bring these ideas into the marketplace so that we understand what we're trying to do is take your budget and use it better. And so take the dollars that you were putting into square footage that you don't use anymore and put them instead into the things that you use every day, make them beautiful, make them enjoyable, and make them energy efficient and sustainable. And you'll notice that this space has 8-foot ceilings. I'm trying to help people who are absolutely convinced that if you build an 8-foot ceiling, you'll probably die because it's really ugly, to understand that it's not 8-foot ceilings that are the problem. It's the lack of differentiation. If everything is all 8-foot, or if everything is all 10-foot, or if everything is all 12-foot, it's boring. We thrive on contrast. And so what I'm trying to show with many of the houses that I've been building is that it's through the variation in ceiling height that we feel vitality. And so you can see just in this picture, the lowered shelves, the dropped soffits or dropped ceilings give an identity to each of those spaces without separating them visually. And that is revolution to most people. They don't realize that you can do that. And so it's about differentiation of place. Now, you may not like the style of this house. What I'm trying to do is reveal the bones underneath the style. So whether you were interested in a Victorian house or a soft contemporary or a Tudor, whatever it is, these ideas apply. And then I show in a number of articles that I've written in Inspired House and Fine Home Building how just taking away that ceiling height changes makes a huge difference. Now look at this again. I actually drew that picture as an overlay from this one. Now, interestingly, what happens is the space becomes much duller, and also, strangely enough, it feels smaller. And I actually got to experience a house that was built from my floor plan without any of the ceiling height changes, and it was very uncomfortable. It was really a lot smaller in feel. So it's the differentiation between spaces created by that third dimension that really makes the difference. The not-so-big house also introduces some really obvious things, like we need a mail sorting place. You know, how much mail do we all get? Granted, most of it's junk mail, but we need a place. We need a place to be able to put the computer, which is integrated into the house, because we haven't named these functions. We don't have places for them. And we also often need a place I call this a place of one's own, but it's a spot for calligraphy, for your hobby, for writing. For me, it's meditation, a place that is where you can become more of who you know you are on the way to being as part of your life. And so it's really recognizing that the more spiritual aspects of our lives need to be integrated into our homes and given a place. I'm actually in the process right now of writing a new book that's not architectural in nature. It's called The Not-So-Big Life. And it's about, really, how do you live a life? How do you understand and integrate into your everyday world that we're all on a journey and we're all learning more and more and more about who we are as human beings? If you can build a place into your home that allows that to start coming into being, that's the first step. And so I think part of why the Not-So-Big House really appealed so much to people was that it really addressed that issue. It's about livability, and it's about the integration of how do we use resources well, right down to how do I create spaces that are going to really nurture me and my family and make me feel me into a better human being. And I realized as I talked about this book around the nation that something as simple as this tile pattern in the backsplash of a kitchen is enough in most houses to make people say, I want that one. Now, why? It's just that somebody paid attention to this design. They thought about it maybe for an hour, designed something beautiful, and in that, there's inspiration. And people are so sensitive to the feeling of being inspired. And unfortunately, with our focus on resale in the marketplace today, we don't even talk about the imprinting of ourselves on our homes. Is it any wonder that people keep moving from house to house to house? Because we've never given people permission to make them their own. And the point I make in Not So Big House is, if you don't do this kind of expressing, you're going to want to move because it isn't you. And our houses are so much a part of who we are. And I have had the same email over and over from literally thousands of people over the last 6-8 years saying, thank you so much for giving me permission to make my house my own. That's it. It's so darn simple. Everything I say in these books is incredibly obvious. It's just that nobody's saying it, and so we haven't integrated it into our understanding. Now, something really interesting happened when I wrote The Not So Big House. I was running an architectural practice of 45 people, had been doing it for about 20 years, and I knew that there was a marketplace for what I was describing, but I had a vision of how my life was going to be. I was going to be an architect in the afternoon and a writer in the morning. But when when the Not So Big House was released in October of 98, suddenly it shot up to number one in all books on Amazon. I was blown away. I wasn't expecting this to happen. And it very quickly became clear that I had been given this microphone in which to articulate a lot of what I'm describing today, and I could either do that or I could continue to be in practice, but I couldn't do both well. And so I decided, since I'd been in practice for a while and knew that marketplace well, I would try this new role. But who were all these people who'd suddenly decided to buy the not-so-big house, and why? Because they couldn't possibly have read it yet. It hadn't been out for long enough. Well, it turns out that at the same time that I was writing The Not So Big House, there was a study done by a demographics group called American Lives. And they identified a new set of cultural values. They looked at the worldviews of the population of the United States and discovered a new group, which they dubbed cultural creatives. How many people have heard of that term? Quite a few of you. Well, it seems as though the cultural creatives of the world, that worldview started at about somewhere in the early 70s. And these folks understand as their most basic, premise that the world is not something isolated from themselves, that every single decision they make has an influence on the globe, so that we are all connected and every single decision is going to have an influence. So these are people who, at their core, have sustainable roots, green roots. That's what motivates them first and foremost. They also tend to be pretty well educated. They're all across age groups. They're all across economic brackets. And they constitute a quarter of the population of the United States. And the media doesn't know they exist. And so that's why this book shot up to number one, because in the name, Not So Big House, it verbalized what all these people were looking for was something that doesn't scream, look at me, look at me, that isn't about being showing off. It isn't about doing the most that they can materially. It's about living these values of being of quality over quantity, of understanding that they're trying to make a place that nurtures them, but that also looks after the planet. And in that body, there was so much that needed to be articulated, and this book articulated very simply quite a few of those things. So it bridged from the spiritual right down to the techniques of how do you heat and cool a house. And that movement, that set of people, is absolutely starving for more information. And I'm sure that 90% of who's in this audience today fit into that mold. That's why I can start this discussion at a different level than I can with the general public, because most of you are already living it. You already are embodying much more than most of what this means. And this audience, cultural creatives, they're voracious readers. They like to learn everything they can about any product that they use before they put it into a house or a building. And once they have that information, if they can afford it, they will hire the best person locally to be able to apply that, ideally somebody who also shares those values. And if they can't afford it, then they will do it themselves, and they will probably do it very well. They care about beauty and harmony. So their whole motivation is so different than what we see in the mass media. It's largely, this group has tuned out of television almost completely. If they watch television, it's likely to be, my old line was PBS, but now it's a few other of the cable channels too. But things that inspire, things that allow them to grow, because that's really what's going on in their lives. And they also listen to NPR a lot. I found before I'd really understood this audience that our best place to quote-unquote advertise with my old firm was to put a tiny classified in the back of the Minnesota Monthly magazine, which was sent to all NPR listeners. We got more calls from that teeny little classified, which incidentally was free if you were a member. So it's, you have to understand that this group is not looking for the same kinds of hard sell. They're looking for education. And so something that for all of us in this audience to be able to find those like folks to just speak clearly what you know and to live it, people are going to find you. It's not through advertising in the normal way. Now, the thing that is perhaps the most powerful part of what I'm describing, and this was a revelation to me as I started to work with residential clients, is that we can all remember back to when we took up residence in a cardboard box, and for me it was the cupboard under the stairs and my grandmother's laundry basket. And we all remember what it feels like to be in that kind of a space. I want you just, in your memories for a second, to go back to that feeling. Now, that is a spatial experience. You got it in your minds? It's you are vibrantly aware of your own little enclosure and your ability to see into a larger space. And it's really exciting and exhilarating. If you want to figure out what the most interesting space in a house is, let a 5-year-old loose for 2 seconds. They'll find it. They look for that kind of spatial experience because it's very exciting. Now, the interesting thing is that architects and many builders have a very sensitive spatial system, spatial awareness. And that the fact that turned them on as a child continued to fulfill them in further in their lives. And so our professions have drawn to it, like a magnet, people who are what I call three-dimensional adepts. They really get it about how third-dimension experience, the heights of everything, affects us. But most of the general public, although they are very affected by the third dimension, don't understand that it's there. So oftentimes when I'm speaking, I'll ask people to look at what's happening in the ceiling. For example, in this room, notice that all the lighting is in this middle cloud that's a little bit lower. And then at the edges, it's taller but darker. And there's a feeling that's created. It actually creates a focus in the middle of the room. Now, architects do this all the time. We use ceilings and lighting in many ways that move you in ways that you aren't aware of. And what's really important is that it has a huge effect on our experiencing of our daily lives. But most people don't know that design actually affects them. They can tell when they like something, but they're not aware of how important it is in the quality of their own existence and the quality of their well-being. So as I started to really understands the magnitude of that, that architects are starting to talk to their clients at a level where we've probably lost our customer before we've gotten three sentences out of our mouths, really, we have to start at a very simple level and explain the importance of the third dimension in how we experience our homes. And so I wrote Creating the Not-So-Big House to really explain this basic idea. If you look at a floor plan, if you look at a city map, you don't imagine that you know what that city is going to look like, right? You know how to get your car around, but there's no idea that you're somehow supposed to know what the city feels like. Well, a floor plan is exactly the same thing. It is a map. It doesn't tell you what the space is going to feel like. And so we have hundreds of thousands of families every year looking through home plan magazines trying to find their perfect home. And they're looking at the map. They're not looking at the part of the information that's going to tell them how this space feels. So people build house after house after house looking for that sense of home, not understanding that the floor plan doesn't contain the information. So this is the floor plan of the second floor of my home in St. Paul, my old house. And that space, I'm going to flip back for a second, is at the far top right-hand corner. Now, most people would look at this floor plan and just assume that it was all, you know, the same height ceiling. And architects know that the dotted lines mean something, and, you know, there's all sorts of things communicated here. Most people have no idea that that's true. So we're using a tool to communicate about what space feels like that doesn't work. And I can't tell you how many of my clients have told me that they thought they were stupid because they couldn't read a plan. Many of them can read a plan, it's just that the information they're looking for isn't there. For that, you need sections and interior elevations and models and things that tell you what the shape is like so that you can see and feel what this is. And the more that we have computer-aided design and virtual reality, we are going to be able to explain that much more effectively, and people will be able to spend their money much more effectively. So it's really, really an important understanding. Now, you may not feel that what I'm describing has to do with green, but believe me, it does, because the quantity of material that is wasted by building house after house that doesn't satisfy is astronomical. And so if we can get this little connection, connecting the dots and understanding that you can make a better house by understanding that third dimension, it's enormous. It's a little bit like this incredible sidewalk art. If you look at this picture for a second, the guy on the left is a drawn picture on the sidewalk. The guy on the right is a real guy. The beer glass and the beer on the right-hand side are drawn, and the beer and the beer glass on the left are real. Now, that is visible because of the angle that we're looking at here. If we were to move an inch or two to either side, we would lose that reality. And unfortunately, what we're doing when we're picking houses with floor plans alone, that's what we're doing. We have no understanding that there's more. If you remember that photograph that I showed you of the two-dimensional house with the brick facade, we're looking at one elevation only. We don't understand that if we move a little bit from side to side, it's not that house anymore. So it's one of those things where we're talking about a dimensional shift here, and it's really, really critical to the quality of our experience. So the last book that I wrote, Home by Design, is now introducing some language that will allow people to refer to some of the qualities that they're looking for in home but don't know how to articulate. How many of you in this room are familiar with pattern language? Lots. Well, Bay Area, what that? Well, I dedicated this book to Christopher Alexander. He was a huge influence on my life and allowed me to understand that everything that we experience can be brought into something that can be named so that others can then see it. And so as one of these three-dimensional adepts, an architect, I started to see my world and started to name things. When I have 30 seconds on the radio, I will describe my favorite one, which is what I call light to walk toward. It's not just a near-death experience. We are physiologically programmed to move towards light. That's what human beings do. And so architects use this all the time. You put a light or a lighted painting or a window at the end of a hallway, and people will walk there. So it's very, very simple stuff. But if you don't name it, you can't duplicate it. So people see this, you know, see homes that they like, and they don't know how to make them like that again. And so a lot of what Andras Dwani and I are doing is simply saying, look, this is how it was done before. We can do it again, and here's how. And then name the parts so that people can actually do that and implement them. I'm not going to do a lot of description of this book, but basically it's broken into three large categories of space, light, and order. Space isn't about square footage. It's about the quality and character of a space. Just like if you have a ceramic pot, for example, the shape of the space inside. That's what architects mean when they talk about space. And then light is the great animator of space. You can have marvelous space, but if you can't see it, you don't know it's there. And then order is something that allows us subliminally to understand what's going on. The way that I describe this is if you think about the ordering system in our bodies, we have the spine that allows everything to move from that spine outwards. And a house or any kind of building has some sort of ordering system that allows you to find your way around it and subliminally communicates to you what it is and how to interface with it. So those are the gross parts. But at their root, all these things require contrast as the animating force. So just as I was describing with ceiling height, if you don't have contrast, you can't tell difference. And without a sense of difference, there's just monotony. So we get vitality from experiencing difference. If you look at this picture, if the tile, the black tile, were the same color as the wood slatted floor, this would fall flat. You wouldn't be able to see the difference. Now, you may not like the style of this, but the point is that what makes it animated is the contrast. So whether you're talking about light and dark, bright color, dark color, tall and short, all of those are contrasts, and they can all vitalize. And I have many pictures in this book that are a feature I call Picture This. So here's an example of a pretty nicely designed, fairly traditional entry hall. And here's what's happening in most of suburbia today. So it's just the extruded floor plan. What happened here is just the walls taken up to the ceiling with no third dimensional design. If we go back, you can see instantly. Now, this is such simple stuff, but most people, this is revelation. They don't realize that somebody had to draw that doorway in order for it to happen. And that's the part that's missing. That's why we don't have this information on the floor plan. That requires something that cuts through the third dimension. Here's another one. Now, this is a principle that I call visual weight. And here, actually, the architects refer to visual weight a lot. Here's a dark-colored ceiling. Here's the same space with a light-colored ceiling. And they're not either one of them right or wrong, but the dark-colored ceiling, the ceiling feels a little lower. It feels more intimate. So for all of these cathedral ceilings all over the country, the very first step is paint it a dark color. And it really helps. It's such a simple thing. And again, it's the naming of the idea. So again, this is not rocket science. It's something that is just helping us to make better houses. And what I'm trying to do behind the scenes is just sensitize people to the fact that there is an enormous amount that we can do to make our houses better places to live, just from an aesthetic level. And if we do that, we have houses that we're going to want to look after in the long haul. The next book that's coming out in September is about details. And when I used the word details, it's called Inside the Not-So-Big House, I thought everybody understood what a detail is. And then I discovered, when I was working with the editorial staff, one of the women said, you know, a detail is like accessorizing, right, interior design? And I said, well, no, details are how things come together, how materials are brought together in a marriage that makes them look beautiful and serve some important function. And none of the staff, the editorial staff, knew that. And probably there's many of you in this audience that don't realize it. Architects use the word detail all the time, and we assume we're communicating. We're not. It's amazing. So what I've described now, this is the way I'm describing this book, is that if you take a camera and you push the zoom button, it'll take you way into a close-up of something. This book is about those close-up pieces. And if you were to take the whole house, turn it upside down and shake, none of it would come off. So it's really just trying to communicate these very simple but very, very important aspects of design so that people can make better houses for themselves, which in turn they will look after and will provide a legacy and some soulfulness for our communities for the future. So what's the house of the future likely to look like? I'm pretty sure we can all agree that it won't look like this, and yet it's very interesting when you look at projections of what the house of the future is going to be, it's almost always some manifestation of a technology. And it's not the technology. The technology is informing the form, but it isn't what the aesthetic ends up being. So we're much more likely in the future to have houses that have more of the vernacular forms that we're familiar with, that say house, but integrated seamlessly into that will be the new technologies that allow the global brain that we are becoming through the web to function. So it's a really important understanding, and it's what the architects of the 1920s and 1930s didn't understand. They left behind everything that had a historical memory attached to it and said, we're going to have a brave new world. And in that brave new world vision, they lost 99% of their customers. So I believe that the house of the future is going to be made very differently than we make it today. I'm very interested in looking at prefabrication of various forms. If I were to articulate what's come to me since I built my own house in St. Paul from a panelized system, these are just the pictures. This was one of the most exciting 2.5 days of my life. So that's what happened in 2.5 days. This took a little longer to get to that point. But the thing that I started to realize is that we have at our disposal today technologies that allow us to try on our houses through virtual reality, through the web. We can communicate so much more about what a house is going to look and feel like. What about this as a vision? In maybe I'd say 5 to 10 years, there will be storefronts in probably every mall in America, and people will use as entertainment the option of going and trying on a house, just like going to the parade of homes today. This will become like going to the theater, except you'll take your whole family and you'll be able to walk through a house and try it on. Now, there will be some serious buyers amongst those, and of those serious buyers, the owner of the store, who I hope will be an architect or somebody trained in design, will help to tailor the house or houses that family is looking at to fit the site that they're looking for, and probably will steer them to good choices for that site. And there will be a whole new industry of house production that will be sustainably made, factory crafted, almost certainly, and beautifully, beautifully made houses that will use almost no energy, will be extremely energy efficient, and a house design will be, we will buy houses in a very, very different way. It's amazing that we're not there already in many ways, but I think it's because people can't feel the results. I think, where we can go and try on a car, we've all sat in those car shows and tried on different cars. People need to do that with houses, and we need really, really good examples of houses out there that allow them to understand all the constituent parts, from the sustainability aspects to the design, the size. How do these spaces feel? They start to realize they don't need as much space as they thought they needed. And there are many options around the country now moving in the direction of what Andres Duany is describing about new urbanism, traditional neighborhood developments. This is a very wonderful precedent in Washington State by an architect called Ross Chapin, who incidentally has a very good website which you can get to from notsobighouse.com. But he worked with the local zoning people and took 2 city lots and converted them into 8 little tiny building parcels. Many of you probably have heard of this this work. But he's created a model that's great for single people or for empty nesters, or people who don't want a lot of area, each of these units is about 650 square feet. And he's now doing other developments that are in the 1,200 square foot range. But there are so many needs for different housing types that we don't have out there. And it's incredibly important for any of us that are in this world helping to formulate and shape the way that our suburbs are crafted, to put forward to the zoning officials, to the building officials, ways that we can do things better. Because oftentimes when you meet those folks, not around a particular project, but just discussing ideas, they're really interested. And if they realize that they have the power to help make this happen, oftentimes they're more than willing to play ball. But it requires us, as those that see that vision, to take action and move forward. I've been putting forward to builders show houses. This was the show house that I did in Orlando for the International Builders Show this year, which incidentally is a variant on the house that I did for the couple that I started this talk out with. This is the Florida version of a Minneapolis house. And obviously what any of these homes requires is a good team. It requires that from the get-go we have a good architect, a good builder, a good energy consultant, somebody that really understands sustainable systems. We had so many people as players on this house. It was really wonderful. People who in the past probably wouldn't have been on the same project, all of them were putting in their insights and assistance in making this an incredibly energy efficient house. I'm not good with remembering numbers, but I think this house would cost $23 a year to heat and cool, something like that. It was very low. And built with SIPS, structural insulated panels. And then also beautiful. So something that it puts forward a totally different vision of what a home can be. And I'm trying to just put more and more of these out into the marketplace, not just so that people can walk through them, but so that they can get an audio tour and hear what the features of the house are about. Christy and I have worked together on a project here in San Francisco, Settling in the City, which is a design, a show house designed by Nova Designs. And I do one of these audio walkthroughs, as does Christy, talking about the green aspects of the project. And if you're interested in visiting it, it's open right now during World Environment Day and also through Pacific Coast Builders Conference. And you can go and listen and see what the potential is for this kind of educational process. So if you go to sfgreen.com, you can find out more about that project. So this is, I know, this is a project of Andres's. This is how it's possible to develop the land, keeping the beauty of what was there, using it to enhance the vibrancy of what gets built, and understanding the scale, the pedestrian qualities. Just like with the house, Andres is talking about the scale and shaping of our communities to really nurture who we are as human beings. So with that as an introduction, please, if you're looking for any kind of resources to do with what I've described, everything from the nuts and bolts level to the spiritual level and everything in between, notsobighouse.com, you can find all of it. And stay in touch, and please keep doing what you're doing, because I know you're all doing wonderful, wonderful work. Thank you so much. Moment's hiatus while we find our next speaker. Here he is. All right. Andres Duany. I think it's, yes, I would.
I've learned to actually speak with my hands, thanks to technology. May I ask a question? Yeah, it looks like it's terminal. The problem is it's always new. It's always a new problem. Let me see if I can actually spare you the images. Have the mayors arrived? Not one, right? Well, I think we have to seriously thank whoever mismanaged them, because it will make this lecture substantially more interesting. And the reason is this, because, of course, I had, in fact, mentally prepared a lecture for American mayors, such things as they could not take home, not only take home and not only understand, but, in fact, that they could communicate to the American population in the manner that we've grown accustomed, which is something approximating a bumper sticker slogan. And one of the most difficult things, in fact, about getting through in the political world is how one has to simplify things. And when one speaks about the environment, and when one speaks about actually the human habitat, it is simply not easily, it is not easily simplified. And now that I do not have to simplify, I can actually speak to those of you who I imagine to be partially designers and developers and partially environmentalists, and not necessarily the same. And so what I would like to speak about today is actually a whole combination of things. And by the way, the nature of my presentation, as you will notice, is a series of apples and oranges. You know, it is not possible to make a coherent proposal when it comes to something as complex as the human habitat in particular. Now, let me begin with an anecdote which remains in your memory. And it has to do with my brother Douglas. And when he graduated from college in the late 70s, he lived in a dwelling that was, by Sarah standards, absolutely extraordinary. It was probably 420 square feet, as he's reconstructed it for me. He walked everywhere. And when he did not walk, he took transit. He didn't have a car. And virtually everything that he purchased by walking, and very little of it was packaged, and he never, ever, ever went to a national retailer, let alone a big box store. Now, who was this Douglas Duane? Was he an environmental saint? You know, by all means, he was an environmental saint. Was he an environmental martyr? He was not an environmental martyr because he loved it. He freely chose to live this way. And where was it that he lived? Do you think it was a woodland in Oregon, a farm, a commune? It was Manhattan Island. It was Manhattan Island. Which is to say, all of you, or those of you, who actually are fortunate enough to live in the city of San Francisco, which is one of the few places in the United States where you can live this way, this environmental sainthood, actually should congratulate yourselves. Now, this is perhaps not as evident as it should be. In fact, I would say that this is not evident at all, and that it has not been connected, this actual situation has not been properly connected to the environmental ethos of this country. And that's what I wish to speak about today. What can we do, in fact, to connect environmentalists to what we're about to undertake, which is pretty much the final assault on the great problem of the American middle-class lifestyle? Now, if you think that that is a little bit, you know, I built it up to say the final assault on the American middle-class lifestyle, you know, which is a bit of a deflation, let us say, I would say not at all. In fact, the American middle-class lifestyle is the greatest environmental problem that the world has. It is the source of it, and in its export version, it will do us in. Do you realize that we are training the Chinese, in fact, to buy cars? That the cities that they're building, in fact, are premised upon the automobile? That Walmart is everywhere in Europe, in fact, destroying the pedestrian sheds of retail in Eastern Europe? That Walmart is in Canada, that has an incredible residue of walkable neighborhoods, And in 6 years from their arrival, they have actually become the largest retailer in Canada. And the arguments that are made are thoroughly misunderstood by environmentalists. Now, what I would like to propose today is that we, the urbanists, particularly we, the new urbanists, actually surrender the design of the city to environmentalists and say, you be in charge. But that this surrender be a conditional surrender, not an unconditional surrender, a conditional surrender, and that the condition be that the environmentalists become expert urbanists. And they have the makeup to do so. Now, is this, in fact, a marriage of convenience? I would say it is a marriage of enormous convenience mutually. And here is the situation. The New Urbanism, the group that actually was founded some 15 years ago, and that, in fact, is the genesis of smart growth, and I would be interested in actually explaining a little bit about the difference and the similarities between smart growth and new urbanism. I think it would be useful to know this. But the genesis of the new urbanism and smart growth, in fact, has reached a plateau. And I would posit that environmentalism has also reached a plateau. And if this slide worked, I could actually show you a diagram as to what we mean by this. And how, in fact, there's a coincidence with a little bit of a lag time with the new urbanists and the environmentalists, and how we've had established a tremendous success, and we cannot seem to get further. And in fact, what's happening is that we lose much too often. The amount of energy being put out by the new urbanists and by the environmentalists, the way we go to hearings, the way we embed more and more legislation. Look at the legislation in California. You know how really the process is draconian, you know, to get a permit. In Florida, there are 5 agencies overlaying wetland and water quality. 5 agencies. And we throw more and more law at it, and yet when you look at the results, not only do we continually lose the hearings, we show up and we lose. The developers still get their way. But beyond that, not only do we lose in that specific daily way, we're actually losing the battle of the numbers. And the problem that we have is that San Francisco, is that California, your state, I'm assuming you're Californians mostly, because your state is growing at the rate of 1 San Francisco every year and 1 Massachusetts every 10 years. And that the process that environmentalists have undertaken to affect the outcome is one that is entirely negative. They're becoming more and more expert at saying no. And the problem is that it's not even no. All they do is grind down the process, thereby making housing tremendously more expensive and scarce, and in the end it happens anyway. Because it's not as if it isn't happening. In the end it happens anyway. So all this tremendous effort, these people showing up, giving their evenings, giving in some instances their lives, to actually stop or affect projects, and the projects happen anyway, and they're mostly, on the whole, they're still sprawl. And that is because the environmentalists only have half the tools. And the tool is the green side of the urban boundary. They do not have the tool that actually allows them to intervene within the urban boundary. Now, I have a slide that I can't show you, that actually shows the map. You know, the poster child of environmental planning, particularly regional planning, is Portland, as you know. We worship Portland. Well, if you go to Portland, and the map would show you, and you see the Portland urban boundary, and I have drawn within the Portland urban boundary those parts of Portland that, in fact, are compact, walkable, and diverse, which is to say new urbanist, the places which are like where my brother lived. And that percentage is less than 20% of what's within the urban boundary. What happened is that virtually everything built in the last 25 years within the Portland urban boundary was sprawl, indistinguishable from sprawl in Southern California, Florida, and Texas. It's really not that different. These are places where you need a car to drive everywhere, that consume land at a tremendous rate, and that actually forced the populace, in fact, the mandatory ownership of automobile, which is not so inoffensive when you realize how much that pollutes and it depletes the petroleum. Okay? So what's happening? What happened to environmentalists? Well, environmentalists, after the great success of 1980 when they passed the urban boundary, actually were dancing in victory outside of the urban boundary. We won, we won, we have a line. And they did not contest what was happening within the urban boundary. And they were bamboozled by developers who, in fact, found that 20-year build-out relatively free of intervention. In fact, Portland developers have had a great ride because it was not contested within. They could go ahead and build the strip shopping centers, the shopping malls, the housing subdivisions, the townhouse clusters, et cetera, because environmentalists had effectively been neutralized. Because environmentalists, having only the tool of green, were unable to assess that what was going inside was a disaster. Now, by the way, this is different from the past 6 years. Portland has gone on a tremendous reform movement, and what is, in fact, getting built in Portland since 2000 is, in fact, a densification and very much a new urbanist model. So we must differentiate the first 20 from the last six. Portland is on it. But there has been another aspect which has happened, and you must know, it's impossible that you don't, that in the last election, essentially the Portland urban boundary was thrown out. And in the worst possible way, which is anything that actually is to be zoned out of development has to be compensated by the full payment of the market value. In other words, it isn't just that the urban boundary is illegal, it's just that you have to pay. Every time you do anything that actually prevents land from being developed, you have to pay full price. Now, that is ruinous, the worst kind of thing. And that was done by our democracy, right, by citizens. And it was well contested and, in fact, and very well funded on both sides. Now, let that be a warning. Not that it won't be corrected. By the way, you should know, because this speech is exceedingly optimistic. It is this. One aspect of a democracy is not, the greatest aspect of a democracy is not that it avoids mistakes, but that it corrects them. Okay, the United States avoids no mistakes. We make them all. From slavery to unwinnable wars, but we, in fact, correct them. And that is of great value, because, in fact, I come from a society, Cuba, that has made the same mistakes for 400 years. And it is profoundly depressing when we continue to, in fact, applaud the next man on horseback who will save us. And their entire societies then, in fact, suffer from a cyclical tragedy. This is not a country that does that. That's why we can fundamentally be optimists. Sarah is on a reform. We're on a reform. We have repeatedly reformed this country. And not the least successful reform has, in fact, been the tremendous success of the environmental movement. You know, I remember I was 13 when Rachel Carson's book came out, and we didn't have the faintest clue about anything at all about the environment, nothing. And if you look at a photograph of New York City in 1960, an aerial photograph, you couldn't see the buildings. The pollution was extraordinary. Now the air is clear. The waters everywhere are incredibly much cleaner. The fish are back on the Hudson, et cetera. And there's environmental legislation. There are hundreds of thousands of environmentalists and hundreds of environmental groups. In fact, the saga of the environmental movement in this country has been one of the greatest and fastest successes, and we must applaud that and actually learn to celebrate. Now, you should know that there's a debate going on now in a web magazine called Grist, called the Death of Environmentalism, and they're actually talking, it's a very long, and basically it's young people, young environmentalists who are saying, you know, the problem with the old guys who are running these organizations is they still think it's the 60s, and it's all about resisting, and it's all about complaining, and it's all about being against things. And in fact, we should celebrate. We should celebrate the great victories because we will draw more people. And besides, Americans are sick and tired of hearing what we're going to die of. And we should actually say, look how well we're doing. Look at how much cleaner New York City air is. Look at how much cleaner the water is. Look at how we're considering now taking the dams down. Look at how the restoration of the Everglades has been funded. What an amazing achievement. Does anybody speak of that when they're environmentalists? They never do. It's always, well, it's not good enough. The Corps of Engineers compromised, and on and on. And these young people are saying, look, those days are over. We're totally mainstreamed. We control, in fact, much of the legislation through which developers have to go. Let us celebrate these victories and move on, because Americans are getting sick and tired of, in fact, of hearing the negativity. We really need to put ourselves in a new footing. Now, it isn't enough to just celebrate. It isn't enough to just say we're in a new footing, we're happy now, happy face, environmentalists. A little green, happy face. That isn't going to do it. Because if you look at what happened with the success of the environmental movement, it wasn't just the protest which so energized people. It was the fact that they presented themselves from the beginning technocratically. It was a technocratic presentation. They didn't just say the wetland. They spoke about the chemicals in it. They didn't just say, you know, I sort of moved forward until my foot sank in the mud, right? And then I called that a wetland. No, they said we have to do a habitat, an HEP. And we said, good Lord, what's an HEP? Well, it's a habitat evaluation procedure, and it's going to cost $45,000 to take 3 months. When, in fact, in the old days, our grandparents, in fact, would actually walk and see where it was wet and say, let's not build here. Okay? And that was done in one afternoon. But the mystique, the fabulous thing about environmentalism was the combination of mystique and technique. Okay? Now, the mystique is intact. The mystique is there. They are, in fact, the only higher morality that we have. The only higher morality. And, in fact, when those who, in fact, come and say it must be this way, in fact, say so from a platform which is, in fact, unassailable. And let me give you an example of how well the environment... It used to be that the last higher morality were the highway builders. Not too long ago, highways had to be built for defense, for the economy, to just have the place work properly, economically, to let the market operate. And highway designers and road designers could actually do whatever they wanted. And you know that they reamed out downtowns mercilessly, destroyed beautiful places, took down trees by the hundred. And just to give you a measure of how powerful they were, they actually laid out highways right across the private estates of the wealthiest people in America, right across the Rockefeller estates in Long Island, because the higher morality was the highway. No one could stop the highway builder. And then about 15 years ago, they wanted to stop a highway in New York City, the West Side Highway. And remember, there was a highway that was there already. They just wanted to stop it from being rebuilt. And you know what they did? They wheeled up one little fish that no one had heard of and does nothing. And that little fish stopped the highway in New York City. And if you want to stop a highway in the Otay Mesa, you find a bird that doesn't like to walk very far without shadow. And since the highway is wider than the pedestrian shed of that bird, well, you can't build a highway, can you? Unless, of course, you put it all up on pylons, which is unthinkable. The fantastic thing about the environmental movement is the combination of mystique and technique. And that must be learned. Now, what they need to do is drastically expand their technique to begin intervening within the cities. Because remember my brother? And I said, you know, he was an environmental saint. He was, but he was not an environmental martyr. He was not an environmental martyr. Because he loved living in Manhattan the way that you all love living in San Francisco, in 400 square foot apartments, et cetera, et cetera, and walking to everything and taking transit. He wasn't forced to do it. An enormous number of Americans willingly, and that's the key, live in very high density with a great deal of diversity. And what environmentalism needs to understand as it extends its technique is that the market will drive this country. This is less a democracy than it is a marketplace, unfortunately, but that's the way it is. And that is why, unless environmentalists understand how to present their ideas, they will fail and fail and fail again. Like, you know, the owl in the forest, and how the environmentalist correctly and poignantly explained that, no, you can't take this forest down because the owl, you see, needs the underbrush so the owl can actually feed on the mice that are in that underbrush. And you know what people thought? They simply could not get, you know, the hardworking American middle class, not just the loggers, the middle class, they couldn't get into the head of the owl. What is it like to be an owl on a branch and having to eat? They couldn't get it. The presentation was not done from the point of view of those, in fact, who have to make the decisions. Now, you know how they could have made a much better presentation? They could have said, you know, you need those woods for camping with your kids. You need those woods for camping. That's why you need those woods, because humans need woods as part of their choice. But no, the environmentalists are saying no humans within the woods. See, the other side is stay out of it. It isn't just the owls, stay out of it. And that is the fundamental mistake. Now, let me explain something about American environmentalism and its uniqueness. American environmentalism had a very distinct history in this world. And environmentalism elsewhere is actually substantially different. It was born in the late 19th century with the National Parks Movement, with actually trying to preserve wilderness. Teddy Roosevelt and all that. Marvelous job when actually by the way, Teddy Roosevelt was an extraordinary hunter. And he understood that we needed wilderness so he could kill things. So he understood it from a selfish point of view. But be that as it were, as it may be, the environmental movement was actually born for the preservation of wilderness. Now, when you preserve wilderness, the first human that enters degrades the ideal. And when the third human enters, the ideal is further degraded. And when there more and more and more humans come in, it gets worse. So American environmentalism was actually born of an adversarial relationship between humans and nature. And in fact, humans were outside nature. There was nature, and there was the world of the humans, the world of culture. Now, European environmentalism, to give you an example, and its progeny in Australia, Canada, etc., in fact, is conceived entirely different, because there was no wilderness in Europe. There was no wilderness left. And the Europeans perfectly understand when they look at a hillside and they see on that hillside a marvelous town, a marvelous, beautiful, aesthetically, functionally walkable town on the hill. You've seen that, the great hillsides all over Europe. They understand that that's positive, that in fact humans can be in nature under certain conditions, both aesthetically and environmentally. In American environmentalism, we do not allow anybody to live on a hillside. Right? Oh, you can't build on steep slopes. Why not? Why can't you build on steep slopes? Well, you know, because it's bad for the steep slope. Well, excuse me, it depends on what you build there. You know, if what you're building is a McMansion of the kind that Sarah, which is a visual disgrace as well as a privatizing of the hillside and ruining of the view for everybody else, of course that's negative. But if you were to build a hill town in which everybody has a view from the hill town, on the condition that they live compactly, diversely, in an utterly green way, well, that is acceptable. Well, that setting is not available to American environmentalists. It's always negative. Any human is a problem. And so it cannot solve, it is ultimately, American environmentalists can in fact not succeed because this country is growing too quickly. It's 60 million in 20 years or 25 years, 60 million new Americans. They cannot be accommodated. And the environmental movement is simply going to explode. And you've already seen what's happening with the rumblings about, in fact, the cost of housing, particularly in California, but everywhere else where there's an urban boundary. And we like to say, well, the urban boundary didn't cause it. Well, it did. Let's confront it. Okay? And it isn't just the actual physical urban boundary. It's the grind of getting permits. And any developer will tell you that why do they keep coming to California, where it takes forever to get a permit? It's so much easier in North Carolina. I mean, you've got to be a nut to try to get a permit in California. The reason is that if you get a permit in California, you win the lottery. Because, in fact, the market is so incredibly constrained. So it is an unsustainable position to just say no, whether you do it by urban boundary or whether you do it by a grinding process such as CEQA in California. There has to be positive propositions. And the positive propositions in a market-driven democracy is to make cities that people love, to make cities that people simply love living in astronomical density, cities that people love to walk to their shops, cities where people love to take transit, cities that are dense enough to have a taxi fleet. So when you do need a car, the taxis are available. And that's quite a density when you do that. Now, how do we get environmentalists to actually create cities that people love? Isn't it just enough to just say, are you guys on board? Right? You're on board. You understand now that you have to burst through the urban boundary and go through and enter urbanism and create an urbanism that people love. To which you say, yes, we understand that. We even understand that in Portland. And if you look at what they're doing, what environmentalists are now doing in places like Portland and Charleston and everywhere where they're active, they're actually not creating cities that people love. And I say, because their technology is entirely from the green side of the line. Okay, in other words, let me just give you an example. Woodland. I have a friend, a new urbanist, who lives in Portland. And there's a square near his house. And that square is being reforested. Because one of the things they've done in Portland is actually say, we're going to green everything now. We did it wrong. We're going to green things. Well, on that square, which is now reforested with bushes, in other words, nature has been brought into the square, do you know what's happened? Every morning, condoms have to be picked up, and the neighbors can't stand it. Because what happens is that sex is marvelous in the wilderness. Sex in nature is marvelous, but not when nature is a square. So the parents cannot go, can't let the kids into the square. And by the way, that's just the sex part. There's also the criminal, all the antisocial behavior that takes place when you bring woodland into a very high density area. Because it is improperly supervised, it actually creates a situation. Let me give you another example. We now, in the latest environmental campaign, there is something called, after water quality and everything has been done. Actually, let me speak about water quality next. You're supposed to handle, and I have slides to show you, you're supposed to handle the rain where it falls, right? Not downstream it. It's supposed to permeate the soil, be cleansed there, and re-enter the aquifer. Well, do you know what it's like to actually try to make an urbanism where a huge percentage of the ground has to remain permeable? You can't make a city. You can't make a city. What you make is a suburb. You make the worst kind of unwalkable, hard-to-maintain suburb. And worst of all, we have laws like that in Florida, in the whole west coast of Florida. We have these wonderful downtowns, and you wonder, they're rather well-located, like many old towns are. Why aren't developers redeveloping the old buildings? What's going on? And it's because there has been unmitigated environmental laws, unmitigated, I mean that in the original sense of the word, environmental laws that prevent you from rebuilding your old buildings, because once you reach that threshold of renovating or of building, you can no longer use the sewage system, the stormwater system. The law that was written that says you must handle your stormwater on site and filter it through is impossible to manage in an old lot. Like, just imagine a shop in a 50 by 100-foot lot. It's in the first 40 feet is the shop, the best 60 is parking. You want to renovate that shop, right? Or even rebuild it into a townhouse. The parking lot in the back has to be removed and turned into a swale, into a suburban swale. And if you don't want to do that, you have to do something very closely akin to building a swimming pool with a sand bottom to handle it. So there's a fantastic disincentive for renovating our traditional downtowns in Florida. And when you speak to environmentalists and say, this is a problem, they say, no, it really isn't. You can just build a cistern. They say, don't you understand? These cities don't make enough money to actually load up the cost of a cistern. These cities need every parking they have, but you see, they only have one way, which is the rural way, the natural way. You can't use the perfectly good storm system because the law has been written with the outside of the urban boundary in mind, only with nature. This is akin to the carpenter, that actually, because the only tool they have is a hammer, they treat everything like a nail. An environmentalist, because the only tool they have is nature, they treat everything by greening it. And when you green things, you turn them into suburbia. In fact, you turn them into Irvine. In fact, Irvine meets the water quality laws. And you know what doesn't? Your beloved San Francisco. There is nothing about this city the density, the degree of pavement, the way the water is handled, the hundreds upon hundreds of streams that are in pipes. Nothing about the city that, in fact, could be built. Not one block of this city could be built with current environmental laws. That is an enormous tragedy, because, in fact, it is precisely the hybrid that people do not like. Yes, they will willingly live in a city like this, in the little apartment with inconvenient or no parking, so long as there is the compensation for urbanism. You understand? Density per se is unacceptable marketing unless there is the compensation of urbanism. Yes, you don't have a backyard, but by God, when you walk out of that front door, you have a street life. And when density is in fact proposed or implemented without the compensation of urbanism, it is a clearly inferior way to live. And that is why people hate and fight density in the suburbs. Who wants to live in a townhouse without a town? You see, once you prevent the building of real cities, then people will actually go to the suburbs. And once you buy into the suburban condition, the small doesn't work. You really want the big yard. You see, once the ideal is nature, it is really to actually create a simulacra of nature in your yard, and for that you need the larger lot. So environmentalists have to understand that at the moment, the best models, market-driven, to prevent sprawl, is not the urban boundary. There isn't one that's holding in this country, nor has there ever been one that has held. That is not the tool. And by the way, yes, you can put them in for 10 or 15 years, there's no doubt. You can put the next urban boundary and it'll hold for 10 or 15 years, but that is as nothing in the timeline that we're talking about. 10 years is nothing. It isn't even your lifetime. It isn't even your political lifetime. It's nothing. Whatever we do has to be permanent. This is nature, guys. Understand the cycles of nature. It isn't just 10, 15, or 20 years. Whatever we do has to work for 50 and 100 and 150 years. And if you look at global warming, that's the window. The window is nobody says it's going to happen in 10 years, does it? Nobody says in 20. The numbers, to be politically remarkable, to be politically effective, they say, well, in 50 years, it's going to go up 1 or 2 degrees. In 150 years. So here we are with environmentalists working with tools that are only sustainable for 10 years, right? And not using the tools, in fact, that are 20 years. And the only tools are those of building great, dense, truly urban cities. And the tragedy is that the environmental laws written in this country don't allow that. You cannot build San Francisco, you cannot build Boston, you can't build Charleston, you can't build anything that you would want to live in as a pedestrian where transit works. And I can give you technical example after technical example. The priority that we give to streams, regardless of where they are, the priority that we give to streams means we clip the grid. Right? The grids are always clipped. Oh, you have a greenway here? Well, you can only cross it once. You know what happens when you cross it once? You get a collector and arterial system because you're actually putting all the traffic. Instead of having the network like San Francisco, New York, and Charleston that distributes all the traffic, that open network that allows the streets to be small and thereby walkable, we dump all the traffic on very few arterials that nobody wants to walk on. And there you have the traffic engineers who prefer that model in collusion with the environmentalists. Oh, we love to clip the grid. We'd like to have a dendritic system of cul-de-sacs, locals, collectors, and arterials. Well, the environmentalists love that too because they continually clip the grid. And as soon as you clip the grid, you can't walk anywhere. Not only do you extend, like the anecdote given, not only do you enormously extend the drive to go anywhere you do, you can only drive because you can't walk on the arterials. So there has to be some kind of standard by which a wetland can be crossed and, in fact, a greenway can be multiply crossed. Now, not everywhere. There needs to be a declension of places. But there are places when one is building a town center, when you're building a city core, in exchange for 80 units to the acre, those developers who build 80 units to the acre, right, are doing their environmental job on the basis of the density alone because those 80 units to the acre are not spreading all over the landscape. So they're actually doing their job, and they should be allowed to compensate those people that are willingly living at 80 units to the acre by saying, let's have a walkable community, and that will include piping some streams and getting the and paving enormously. Like what's the pavement in San Francisco? Look outside. You know, Times Square. Just to give you an example, I counted Times Square. Times Square has 4 trees, and none of them are happy. Okay? Now, by the normal assessment, Times Square is the worst environmental disaster in the world, isn't it? I mean, it's nothing but a heat sink. It's about 100% paved. And yet, Times Square is clearly not an environmental disaster, is it? Because remember, the 10 million people that visit Times Square are not out in Yellowstone bothering the bears. Do you see? Do you see how you need the balance? I mean, it is absolutely coordinated, the balance. Times Square is not part of the problem, it is part of the solution. Now, let us take the ecological footprint. Let me give you one more example in terms of the problem. Now we have something called night lighting or dark sky. And people who, in fact, want to fight developers say, oh, you're going to sort of confuse the birds, right? If you have bright lights, you're going to confuse the birds, or the turtles can't breed, whatever. You know, in the case of Florida, because the lights will confuse them. You know what happens when you don't have bright lights in your city core at night? Well, the young humans leave town, because it's the job of young humans to increase the genetic pool to which they're exposed to. And that requires an extended day after work so they can meet the opposite sex in great quantities. That's their job. And whenever you have a town that goes dark, the young people leave. And you'll see this all over America. The young people aren't staying. Why? And you talk to them. You know, we do public processes a lot. Why are the kids leaving? Oh, there's nothing happening here. What do you mean there's nothing happening? Well, there's nothing happening here. What do you mean there's nothing happening? They go to Chicago, they go to New York, et cetera, and that's because of where the genetic pool is. So you can't just say, we need dark sky, right? Because dark sky is affecting the humans. They're no longer, in fact, staying in the decentralized network of small towns and villages that we have in this country, when, in fact, it has never been easier to stay in a small town or village. Remember when it used to be really boring? Well, now entertainment is beamed in. All the channels are beamed in. Remember when retail used to be a problem? Hey, it's delivered next day by FedEx. What's your problem? There is no downside to small town living anymore, except for the lack of genetic material. And so it is incredibly important. And by the way, after you've successfully bred, it's wonderful. You go back. You know, it's a wonderful place. The kids can walk to school, et cetera. But what we have is a situation. By the way, and I was careful to actually propose this in a way that environmentalists can understand. Biological. I mean, we understand that. We understand that humans actually have certain needs. But the fundamental idea, the fundamental first step, is that environmentalists, to save the reputation of environmentalism, have to make positive propositions. They can't just say no. The greatest of positive propositions is the obverse of the greatest negative outcome or symptom, which is the American suburban lifestyle. They have to get on how do we get Americans in a market economy to live in cities. So they have to learn how to live in cities. They have to learn how to build cities again, and for that they have to completely transform their vision into one in which green, literally green, is not the only way to do it, but in fact pavement is the way to do it, however counterintuitive that is. So you then don't end up with Irvine. Now, there's a graph I'm not going to show you, but it looks like this. It looks like this, okay? Now, what is the measure? What is the measure of the graph, okay? Let's measure diversity, okay? That is a measure that is often used in nature. Well, we're decreasing the diversity. Let's take diversity as the currency of exchange. So you have a graph in which you have the wilderness on one side here and the urban core on the other, right? Wilderness and core, like that, okay? Diversity drops in a linear way. Natural diversity drops in a linear way so that it is highest at intact wilderness and lowest at the urban core, right? At downtown Manhattan. It's the lowest. Now, when you do that, when you have the high to low, suburbia, i.e. Irvine, with all the green, actually rates higher than Manhattan. Irvine rates higher than Manhattan. Now, look at Irvine. Look at it. You have to drive absolutely everywhere. There's social segregation to no end, and it consumes petroleum, which in turn, by the way, the secondary consequences of petroleum isn't just pollution, because actually there are technical fixes for that, but all the social problems that come from social isolation, et cetera, that are in fact in our book out there. I don't need to rehearse that anymore. But the problem is, the tragedy is that when you judge diversity, exclusively natural diversity, the suburb rates higher than Manhattan. And we continually run across environmentalists fighting hard the new urbanist attempts to make real cities. Now, let us say that you fold in both natural diversity, right, and social diversity. Let's say you fold them both. Okay, and we start again. Well, over here in wilderness, natural diversity is very high and social diversity is very low. But on the urban core, social diversity is very high, right? That's where the poor people live next to the, you know, and the school teachers are there and the grocers are there, you know, which is the great mix of urbanism. So social diversity is very high at the core. So if you mix them together, both diversity, social and natural, the graph goes down and then goes up again. And the lowest point is exactly where it should be, in the suburbs. And that's a formula that actually works and represents the ideal outcome. And not only does it do that, but it actually says that those of you who live in the suburbs, you're welcome to do this because it's America, okay? And Thomas Jefferson screwed it all up by saying that we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as our rights. And by the way, happiness is self-defined, so you can imagine. By the way, the Canadians don't make so many mistakes in their planning because their triad is freedom, order, and good government, which means you behave. Well, and that's, Canada has an entirely different situation. There are some Canadians here, it's completely different. I mean, planning in Canada is planner's heaven. I'll tell you, it's very different. But anyway, you have a situation now in which the formula of assessment being diversity, both social and environmental, and it's lowest at the center. So what can we do for those who demand to live in houses? Well, you can't stop them. What you can ask them to do is to lift their abysmal performance by greening their buildings. And it isn't the same to green an urban building, right, or to green a rural retreat with logs. Those are both doing their job. Anybody who lives in very, very low density, right, is actually a guardian of open space. God bless those who live in 40-acre tracts, you know, and hold them and manage them and pay taxes on them, because, in fact, they're keeping open space open. Don't bug them. Also, don't bug those who are living in high density, and don't celebrate so much when the downtown buildings are greener. It's okay. Concentrate on the houses. And those houses are where, in fact, buildings can be the most green. That's where a green roof really does work. That's where orientation, correct solar orientation, is possible. Not downtown, it isn't, but correct solar orientation. That's where, in fact, recycling is possible. That's where composting is possible. That's where growing your own fruits and vegetables and herbs is possible. Do you understand? That's where carpooling is necessary, not only possible. So you concentrate. So immediately the environmental movement actually sets up preserving open space wherever they can, becoming experts at the urban density, and pushing really hard for green buildings at the center in the suburbs, and not getting into the complete dead end of banning suburbs. Because what you're doing is actually minting libertarians by the day. And the libertarians are at least as clever as you are. At least, and you see what they're doing, because they actually ran the operation in Portland. So don't be so stupid as to attack this American single-family house, but simply say, green it. And then establish legislation which, in fact, exempts the urban core, literally exempts it from the conventional environmental measures or metrics of water, of setbacks, Let me just give you an extreme example, show you how radical this has to be. We were doing a project on the St. Lucie, on the St. John's River in Florida, downtown Fort Myers. And we're trying to make a downtown in which Floridians will willingly live in high density. And we actually built a kind of embankment. Actually, it preceded us, but there was an embankment that was about a quarter mile long on the St. John River, which was at the edge of the town. You know what an embankment is like. You can see the water. But in order to build that embankment, the people who preceded us were actually forced to plant mangroves in front of it. And by the time we got there, the mangroves had grown and you couldn't see the river. You couldn't see the river. And we asked the local environmental, the many environmental agencies in Florida in charge of mangroves, and we said, can we cut down the mangroves, right, to about waist height? By the way, it doesn't affect the roots, you know, where the fish are actually breeding. And they said, no. They said, no. I said, but excuse me, this river is 1,400 miles long. 1,400 miles. There are 2,800 miles of, 1,400, I'm sorry, 170 miles long, sorry. 170 miles long, okay? That's double that, that's 340 miles of coast of riparian corridor. Can't we have a quarter mile for the humans to reward them, for living densely? And they said no. Because environmental law only has one setting, which is wilderness, you see? So there was absolutely no understanding that in order to make this downtown attractive, like Paris, like London, like New York, like Havana, where humans have access, in fact, to a water without the mitigation of a wetland in between, they can actually get close to, you know, the embanked waterfront, Charleston, as a reward for living densely, that, in fact, was not anywhere in the picture, thereby undermining our attempt, in fact, to persuade Floridians. And these are environmentalists fighting unsuccessfully the urban boundary without crossing the boundary and saying we really must fight for downtown. I continually do infill projects. Did 1,500 units in Columbia, South Carolina last week. All sorts of people showed up. Did a single environmentalist show up to say we want this to happen as I was thrown there to the lions of opposition? Did a single environmentalist? We're now designing, actually doing the new code for the city of Miami, in which is a great pressure to lower the density of Miami. Miami is a very dense city, and we want to densify it. We want to make it successional. We want to take it to the next level. And there's a squabble on the urban boundary. Lots of environmentalists are out there, because for the first time in 6 years, the urban boundary is going to expand probably 300 acres. They're all fighting out there in the suburbs. They're all fighting against that expansion of the urban boundary. And I've spoken to them, the Sierra Club, would you please come in and back our attempt to raise the density in downtown Miami? And the answer could not be clearer. They said, that's not our agenda. Absolutely. They didn't even dissimulate. They didn't even falsify an understanding. They didn't have the political decency to lie to me. They told me that was not their agenda. Well, of course they're going to lose that battle. They're going to lose that battle within a year, and they're going to lose it 5 years from now, and 10 years from now, and 15 years from now, and they're never going to win that battle. Because the battle, in fact, is not at the urban boundary, the battle's at the urban core. That is where environmentalists have to be. Okay? And the essential message for the second decade of the new urbanism is that environmentalists really must become urbanists. And it's not dissimilar. And in fact, in many ways, it's much more exciting. It's more like the 70s again, when the battles are still being fought, when the legislation is being written. Those of you who actually are nostalgic for the smell of gunpowder of battles past, and as you become environmentalists, that what you do is say, oh, unfortunately, what I become now, when I graduate from environmental school, I'll pretend to, in fact, go out and strike for things. And in fact, but you're going to become an administrator. You're going to become an administrator of existing laws. Well, there's a movement now that, in fact, is at the point where environmentalism was in the 70s, writing its laws, fighting the real battles, dealing with the traffic engineers, convincing the developers, and so forth. And those of you who have the personality, or at least the nostalgia for combat, where it's happening is in the recovery of cities. And that, in an unillustrated way, but created with my hands, is what I have to say. Thank you.
I wonder whether there are going to be any questions. Have we got the microphones and everything set up for everybody? You guys would like to take it
here?
Yeah.
So what we will do is we've got some folks in the here with microphones, and they will try to get to you if you can raise your hand. I hate to say this, call on people, but I think we can create some order that way. And we've got about 45 minutes for questions, and it might be useful if we could do a question for maybe for Sarah and a question for maybe Andres. Does that work for folks? Okay. I've got a bunch of questions, so if nobody else. Right here.
Andre brought up the idea of orientation. I wonder if you could comment on that as well.
As far as orientation
For solar exposure and building integrated photovoltaics.
You know, I want to answer that question, but I want to actually say an insight that I had as you're talking is that what I'm describing is that suburbia. You know, that's where we have to attack the challenge. So everything to do with solar orientation, to do with photovoltaics, how we are integrating solar energy and energy efficiency, insulation, all the techniques need to be brought to bear, especially at that marketplace. So what I'm trying to do is to illustrate all of those things in house after house after house. And that's the best way to teach people that it isn't separate. When I started architecture, I started as an energy expert, and I used to teach about solar energy introduction and integration into houses around the Midwest. And I was part of an energy group, and I got so frustrated because all of the design types did their design and then asked me to do energy to it. I'm sure we've all been there. And it was so obvious that this is absolutely impossible. It's got to be integrated from day one, and the understanding of orientation and everything else has to be there. And as the technology changes, so our integration capabilities are, you know, shift and change. And are different from part of the country to the part of the country. I can't tell you when the double envelope house was really popular for a few years, maybe 20 years ago. I talked to people in climate zones where that didn't work. But they saw the light. They were going to build their double envelope house no matter where they were in the country. And it started to make me very aware that there's a it's the same issue. You know, that was in my energy efficiency days, you know, separately. But I tried to help people understand that you've got to have an understanding of the whole. And this is all about integration. And so with suburbia, we've got to find a way to help them see how their values are found and their lives improved, just like what she was saying about the city. You know, people love to live there. There's a way to make a better house. And it's not that they're doing good. It's not that they're simplifying. It's that they love it. And that's what's going to motivate Middle America.
Yes, right over here.
For Andres, I'm an environmentalist that's attempting to be an urbanist. And what I've found is when I go and say, I'm sorry, but the density at this location next to a train station in the downtown of the largest city of a particular county is too low, people on the one hand can't believe that an environmentalist is saying that, but on the other hand, they don't want to go there.
Yeah.
And so what is the repository of urbanist thinking? It's the culture has been lost, right, among planners.
Yeah.
The decision makers have no idea And transitioning from a suburban space to an urban space, it represents a cultural journey that is to a terra incognita. Right. And so how do we do these transformations? What resources are available to us?
It's important to speak of technique. Remember I spoke about mystique and technique. Environmentalists, in fact, combine that brilliantly. And the new urbanists, in fact, have a great deal of technique behind them. And every time we run across a problem, which, by the way, stumps us for years, there's enough of us thinking about it that we actually arrive at some kind of proposition. And here's the problem. This is obviously huge, isn't it? If you ask people what they want, they do not want their streets connecting. They don't want diversity, either social, economic, or in terms of use. And they don't want density. And in fact, many of them don't even want walkability. They don't want anyone walking past or behind their houses in greenways, as you probably all know if you've been there. Okay? Therefore, the public process is a problem. Now, one cannot say democracy doesn't work. You can't just say democracy doesn't work. What you have to say is the public process as currently constituted doesn't work. Right? So what did we finally arrive at? We actually realized that the public process was not democracy. In fact, they're tiny, specialized, self-selected minorities that make the decision for the entire community. Whenever you say, we're going to densify a project here, and you have to notify everybody within 1,000 feet, you're actually creating a series of specialists that represent only their own interests and not the community as a whole. Now, in Western Australia, they have the following method. Whenever a project is to be done, they actually get, let me not give the anecdote, let me just tell you. What you need is a random sample. Do you realize one of the reasons when Americans, in fact, vote in very small numbers, it actually doesn't affect the outcome? Because, in fact, statistically, the result is exactly the same. If 15% vote, it's the same as 80% vote, unless it's somehow distorted. You know, by some manipulation of something or other, like vote box or buses being taken to poor neighborhoods. But the fact is that 1,000, you know, these people who do studies, Yankelevich and so forth, they only do a huge sampling is 2,000 people. They don't often do 2,000. So 15 million is enough if it were that way. The important thing is not the number, but that they be randomly selected, and then democracy operates. The problem with the current process is that we only call in the neighbors. And, of course, the neighbors are against everything. They're against the school. I'm now in a fight against a playground, let alone a school or a shop or affordable housing. A playground. So what we do is the following. We say, okay, there's the developer who wants to build it. That's a vested interest. There are the neighbors who we call in. They're a vested interest, but we don't confuse them with the citizenry as a whole. And then we use a random sample like the voter rolls or the jury rolls and bring in 200 or 300 people that represent the community as a whole. And they actually get to discuss in front of the elected officials. And the elected officials are very clear. That's the developer that's a vested interest. That's the neighbor that's a vested interest. And these 300 that essentially come in are, in fact, they represent the community as a whole. And suddenly, the intelligence of true democracy kicks in. Mm-hmm. We cannot confuse the public process as currently constituted with democracy. In fact, it's a tiny mob. That's what it is. It's a self-interested, highly specialized, highly organized towards a certain end mob. The problem is that they're organized. And what you need is a disorganized random sample. In fact, just go to the phone book and choose 300 people randomly. And that will be more representative democracy than actually calling the 1,000 neighbors. It's a total dead end to call in the neighbors. It makes things extremely expensive. And much too often, not always, but much too often, the outcome is, in fact, probably the wrong one for the community as a whole. So that's what the new urbanist proposition is. Make it democratic.
Can I tell a story, just piggybacks on that? Is there anybody here from Corvallis, Oregon? Because I gave a lecture in Corvallis probably 2-3 years ago that absolutely blew my mind. Corvallis has done something amazing. They have a festival in summer called Da Vinci Days, and they've coupled up with the university, and the city managers have figured out that that they can actually educate their populace by bringing a speaker that can address an issue that faces them as a community. And so they had invited me because they knew that they were getting urban sprawl, they knew that they wanted to help people understand that bigger isn't better, but also that density works. And there were 1,500 people came to this lecture out of a city of 50,000. That is an unbelievable return.
That's probably the number of people who vote.
It might be, but what I could see is Corvallis is a very environmentally active community, and they were hitting a wall. The city officials were hitting a wall where they could tell that this whole issue of not in my backyard was coming up. And there was a sea change of attitude after my lecture. And I could just see how powerful it is.
See,
when
because it was a random sample.
It was a random sample.
If it was
sample,
a single project with 1,000 feet around
the outcome would
have been totally different.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how small the random sample is, virtually, so long as the key to democracy is random. The randomness is where the wisdom lies. As soon as it becomes specialized, you lose the intelligence of the common intelligence.
Yeah. And the power of what I was seeing there was just that the enlightened attitude of the people that were running the city to see that they're, by educating their populace, they could make changes that they couldn't possibly have done otherwise.
I think we should use the jury rolls to bring people in for important civic projects, like the area around a station. And by the way, it's highly respectable when you say, and this is the random sample of the community as a whole. The neighbors are shown immediately for what they are, which is specialized. You don't confuse them any longer. They don't even sound like they sound like what they are, which is, in fact, a tiny, self-interested minority. And it's totally clear. That's all you have to do.
Speaking as that person, I guess, I live in a community in Vallejo, and along the river, looking down on the river, and I've been a student of designing my own spaces and houses and yard and garden, and tried to participate in the process of decisions being made in our community along our riverfront, which we have great opportunity. And we are labeled just as you spoke. And I actually tried to contact your firm years ago and was sent your book, and I've always respected what you've done, but I find that quite often you are sort of categorized as the opposition, and having participated in the process for 15 years and been part of all the meetings and seen the charade, not charrette, and had the monologue not and manipulation as opposed to dialogue and really something coming of the community that the community was trying to invest. And such great opportunity with old buildings in a downtown core and buildings on Mare Island, which has been transferred from the Navy. Absolutely incredible opportunity. And to create a Golden Gate Park in concert with density, being part of a group that said, let's take your footprint, keep the same amount of housing or whatever, but just densify it and push the envelope back and have open space and celebrate. You build up, you don't have boundary lines, and therefore you give someone a living room or a front yard, and that being open space, the campus idea. Mm-hmm. But you know, you meet opposition and you are labeled. What do you do? And why don't you come and inform them?
Okay, I have to give you, if I were to give you specific advice, I could actually give you some very bad advice inadvertently. You know, this is like there's a particular pathology to every place. I would have to see your river, what's going on, the density, who the developers are, whether anybody wants to live, you know, the market, segmentation, everything. But so I don't want to give you bad advice, which inevitably it would be. And the reason I can't go is that there's not enough people, is that already I never go home, as it is, unfortunately. And And there need to be more new urbanists.
Yeah.
That's really the key. And by the way, one of the things about new urbanism, which you will see time and time again, whether there's a Congress occurring in Pasadena next week. You know, for those of you who want to see what it's really like, it's really amazing. And what you will find is that the level of discussion is extremely high. Now, what's the result of that? The result that we maintain the level of discussion high is that it remains an elite organization. We're never more than 2,300 people. We've been 2,300 people for 10 years. Anybody can join, and as many people join every year as leave. But what happens is by maintaining the discourse at a very high level, you get only the people who can actually sustain complexity. Anybody who simplifies things, I always say, it's great, I'm so glad you're well-intentioned, why don't you join Rails to Trails? You know, some kind of simple, easy thing. Because in fact, what we have here is extremely complex things. Another thing that happens is my presentation, such as it was today, actually blaming environmentalists and all this kind of thing, and just talking it like it is very new urbanist. And it's very unusual in American political discourse to actually be quite so politically incorrect. But for some people, it's absolutely, it's so refreshing. It's the only fresh air there is. And there are a lot of ideas. By the way, smart growth, I forgot to say, I should say something about smart growth and new urbanism. New urbanism, we have the same outcome in mind. We want compact, diverse communities that are walkable, that in fact maintain open space. The difference is this. New urbanism was born when private developers build communities like Seaside and actually found that people love them. And new urbanism is actually private sector driven. Okay, the market drives them. Smart growth grew out of a chance we had in Washington with Clinton to actually establish policy. And smart growth is actually policy driven. And we're great buddies, but it depends who you call in. If you call in a smart growth person, just don't even mention smart growth in Texas. Okay, just don't. And they'll tell you. They will tell you. Call it new urbanism, don't call it smart growth. And then elsewhere, they consider new urbanists to be anti-environmentalists. That's fine. It's the same outcome. But know that smart growth is policy-driven. New urbanism is, in fact, market-driven, and that both are available tools. And I can present one or the other, depending on where I am. In fact, I will write a book called The Smart Growth Manual, mm-hmm. You know, for certain blue states. And then we'll have a new cover for the red states.
That gentleman right there. Andres, could you comment on the Lead for Neighborhood Developments initiative?
The what? I'm sorry, I didn't...
Lead for Neighborhood Developments, the USGBC effort to combine...
Oh, yes, it's very exciting. Look, one of the problems with environmentalists having only half the tools, you know, the hammer that I mentioned, is that they're doing such disgraceful things as accepting gifts from Walmart. You know, they're doing that now. Walmart has decided to give them, what, $30 million in 5 years? Yeah. To buy $30 million is what they sell in underwear this week to begin with. But what happens is they're so pleased, these environmental groups, from getting that open space purchased by Walmart that they're actually giving Walmart a good name. And you can see it in the ads. You can see the cover environmental groups are, when in fact Walmart is a comprehensive disaster, right? Because you have to commute 15 or 30 miles to the super Walmarts, causing pollution. You know, everything they bring is 3,000 miles away, and they destroy the main streets that are walkable. So they're a comprehensive disaster being given cover by environmentalists that only see we're getting open space. The other thing is there are environmental groups, such as the ones that protect the coasts around Washington and Maryland, that actually build their headquarters, very, very green buildings, built out in the woods, practically, where everybody has to commute to them. Now, for those who understand, we say these people just don't get it, do they? They just don't get it. So the USGBC, which is the United States Green Building Council, which actually has written the material for standards, the LEED standards for commercial buildings and large residential, are about to do, I hope you're involved mm-hmm. in the one for houses now.
They're marginally, but...
Marginally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're together with the New Urbanism to write the CNU, the Congress of the New Urbanism, to write the standards for communities. And within a year, will come out standards by which communities will qualify for various LEED ratings. And it was very, very hard to actually get them to understand that sometimes, some places, we do have to, in fact, put a stream in a pipe. Mm-hmm. Just so you all know the Ramblas in Barcelona, right? The Ramblas, the great social center that brings people and makes Barcelona really great to live in. It's built over the river. And if we were a river, it wouldn't work socially. And I'm not saying the rest of the river, that river has 100 miles that's daylighted, but at one point, when it enters that center, and environmentalism is being achieved by other means, they do, in fact, pave it over. And it's just that flexibility. It's just giving environmentalists the full range of tools. You understand? The problem is they only have half the tools. And so you keep building the same structure that isn't actually... It's not fully equipped. It's not a fully equipped proposal that's being made.
Yeah.
Could I get a question for Sarah? Yes, sir. Yellow shirt here. Looks yellow to me. Right.
Actually, my question is for both Andres and Sarah. Andres, a few years ago, you pioneered the idea of the lifetime house, the house that evolves over the span of the life of its inhabitant. Could you describe it? And Sarah, could you say what you think about it?
A few years ago, Life magazine asked us to design a house. Remember, there was a Life magazine house that Michael Graves and Bob Stern did it, and they actually did various aesthetic proposals for the house. And we said, why don't we do something that's actually useful in terms of a lifespan? And we designed a house that began as a small cottage, you know, for a starter house, and could grow for a family, you know, and actually increase in wealth. Also, the kitchen, the little kitchen becomes a bigger kitchen. That's not easy. And the small bedroom becomes a master bedroom as you accumulate wealth over time. At least that used to be the old model. And then the hardest thing of all is, how do you shrink the house so you can stay in it while becoming an empty nester, right? And so we did it with a series of doors that open and shut. It was like an English farce, you know. You open the door and you could actually rent a unit and so forth. And it was really quite an extraordinary house in terms of the lifestyle of an American family. And it was very clever, and it was bought by a lesbian couple.
Well, maybe I'll comment on this by saying that my old firm did the house the year before for Life magazine.
Right.
So we did
That's
one
right.
in 1999, and it's a good segue into something I wanted to bring up here.
Right.
So I'm going to sort of change the question just a little bit. But one of the things that I've been so frustrated by in that middle piece of suburbia that we've been talking about is that how we value houses in this country is an incredibly big retardant to our being able to change. So follow this metaphor. It's a little complicated, but it's really important to grok. If we were to value cars based on the garage that we park them in, that's what we're doing with houses. It's as though we talk about location, we talk about square footage, number of bedrooms. And we look at that as somehow saying how much this house is worth. Now, we know that a Lexus is going to be worth something different than a VW, is, you know, less different than a Yugo. And yet, the way that we do this in our culture today is that when we park that car into a garage, if the garage is in a high-end neighborhood, it's a high-end house.
Yeah.
It's absolutely nuts, and it's hugely driving why houses are getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So we really need to take a look at this. And one of the goals that we had with the Life Dream Houses that we did two. And the goal was to show how one floor plan, back to the message I was talking about in my talk, one floor plan can generate two houses that are twice as much in cost as the other.
Yeah.
Because people don't understand this. They don't understand the complexity, the quality of materials, the character of the interior, et cetera. You know, so there's a whole bunch of stuff.
There was in 1982, Liz and I bought a little BMW, and a great uncle, a really old style great uncle, couldn't believe that we bought a car like that. He says, you should have bought an American car. You get more metal.
Right. As though we would buy cubic
This is actually,
inches.
That was very funny at one time. That's what we do with SUVs now. You get more metal.
Right. I actually, in the not-so-big-house, joked that we don't buy cars by the cubic inch.
Yeah.
But we are
now. We're beginning to.
We are.
I mean, we are buying cars by the cubic inch, exactly. Right. More metal. Right. It's just like my retarded uncle.
Right.
How about this lady here, right in the front row?
So a question for Sarah. I heard you a lot of times not talking to the architecture profession, saying, oh, the architecture profession understands these things. Well, I don't think the architecture profession does.
Right.
And I think that we need a little more of this in the schools, a little more understanding of how to talk to a client about space, but also how to understand space. Because what I see in some of the, you know, students coming into, you know, being put on my projects by the architect, they don't know how to draw with a pencil, which I think is a problem, too. They are looking at the computer screen. They don't have a sense of what they're designing. And it is getting too fragmented in terms of they're working on this computer drawing that they really have no understanding of how it's translating into the three-dimensional space. And I think that's becoming a real big problem.
We're actually in a very interesting period, and we have been for about at least 10 years, where the technology has forced a peculiar situation. What I call the old dads of architecture, the people that really know how to put a building together and really know how to draw, are dissociated from the new group of younger people who can now use a computer very adequately, but never haven't been able to learn what the older guys know. And so there's this kind of weird middle ground. And I don't think it's going to last very long, quite honestly. But we're moving to new tools, new communication tools. And the people that you're having the frustration with haven't learned enough about how to communicate effectively to be able to make the tool do what they need it to do. And I suspect there's new tools coming, too. I mean, I think that we're very limited by this darn screen right now, which sort of makes that information only accessible if you're right there. You know, it's a peculiar experience. But to the issue of, do architects really know all this stuff? I'm doing two things. On the one hand, I'm telling homeowners what they need. On the other hand, I'm telling architects, homeowners need this stuff. And although neither group has completely understood the marketplace yet and what's possible, by saying that it's there, there's a lot of architects that are really trying to get it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really helping them to see the vision that they need to communicate in a different way, which is enormous. And that is absolutely needed in the schools. Mm. There's more a need for people to understand themselves better. As designers, if you don't understand yourself, there's no way you can help your client. Yeah. So there's a whole aspect of learning about your own process of design, not trying to make an ego statement, which is the fear that most clients have about what architects are going to do, and then help to really draw out of their clients what it is they're dreaming about and make it a reality. So it's a very important educational process on both sides.
Because there are a lot of architects present, and I haven't addressed the new urbanism in architecture, which is, you know, enormously controversial and usually misunderstood. Going back to what you were saying, and Sarah, by the way, in our office now, the really cool jobs are the drawing ones. And computers are totally uncool, and it's considered hardship to be told to do a computer drawing. So the reversal is on the way. Fortunately, our school, University of Miami, teaches our kids draw like angels. That's part of the education there. They also do computers. Now, about the new urbanism and style. Students, what distorts architects is that in architectural history, which is very, those of you who are not architects, there's no profession that studies history, its own history, as hard as architects. Okay, the doctors don't know particularly their history, the environmentalists don't know their history, the lawyers don't know their history. But really, architects are taught a lot of history, and in that history, they're only shown masterpieces, which totally distorts a student, because he only sees geniuses.
And that's, he or she believes that they should be a genius.
And if they don't, they're a dismal failure.
Right.
Now, there's distinction that we make. First of all, you work for patrons, clients, customers or victims, okay? And patrons, we clearly differentiate those people who, like, for example, Frank Gehry in Los Angeles, Frank Gehry anywhere, Richard Meyer, any of these architects who are willing, you know, they know, the patrons know they're buying high art, they're willing to pay for it, they're willing to put up with it, they're willing to put up even with technical failure for it. Like, you know, Frank Gehry writes contracts, in fact, that do not have, there are no liability clauses. If it leaks, it's not their fault. Okay? And clients willingly, and patrons willingly send it. Now, clients is what sometimes we refer to. Clients you actually meet.
Right.
They know enough and you bring them along. You educate them, which is what Sarah does.
Right. And they become part of the process.
They become part of it. You know, they know enough to hire an architect or a designer and you bring them along in a dialogue. New urbanists, we don't do the architecture. We do the planning. And builders, developers, don't have clients. They have customers. They never see you. Now, what happens is when we launch a series of designs, I'm not there at the sales office explaining all the cool ideas. They have to meet the people who are coming in sufficiently that they engage. And if they don't, you know what happens when they don't? If they don't get the house, they simply turn around and buy somewhere else.
Right.
And the client goes, and the developer goes bankrupt. Unless you're in a highly constrained place like San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York, which is where you see a lot of the modernist architecture. For example, Dwell magazine. Absolutely marvelous, extraordinary magazine. I love it. It's the one magazine I read, but I know very well it's for clients. Like if I were to put out a modernist building, unless it's a very small project, there are not enough people that understand it. And Dwell should make the distinction. Instead of dumping on the poor architects that are actually dealing with customers, they should make the distinction between people who have clients and people who have customers. The customers you do not meet. And in an open market where there's always a choice, they'll go and buy elsewhere. Now, there's something peculiar in this country. I know there are architects here that do marvelous affordable housing, for example, in San Diego. And you say, well, how come, and actually, architecture magazines often show fantastic affordable housing. Notice they never show the middle-class traditional houses for customers. They show houses for clients, and then houses that are affordable.
Right.
And that's because victims don't have a choice. If you're poor, you will actually put up with whatever the dwelling looks like, even if you would rather not. Remember all those houses by Sam Mockby in the rural studio? Well, these are people, obviously, he's perfectly targeted. He couldn't sell those houses to the middle class. It's perfectly targeted to the rural poor who are quite grateful to live in these strange shaped things. Now, by the way, I'm a trained architect. I have advanced degrees, all this stuff. I understand advanced modernist architecture, and I love it. I really love it. But I never saddle our developer clients with it because, in fact, we don't get to meet the clients. We have customers. And until the profession, both in the schools and in the publications, begin to make distinctions and don't get confused, how can you in the same magazine show a Frank Gehry building that's, you know, 600% over budget, right, then show these exquisite houses for clients and then dump on the new urbanism?
Right.
When it's not the same market. We're not even in the same universe.
It's such a huge issue.
It's a huge issue.
In the architectural world.
And in the architectural world, you never let the kids work with the middle class, do you?
Right.
In the architectural schools. Never the middle class, because the middle class has choice in this country, and it's terribly difficult. By the way, the reason the middle class in Holland and in France and in England live in marvelous houses is that they don't have choice. Okay, it's a highly constrained environment, but in the good old U.S., we have a choice, and you will always have traditional architecture. And until Dwell deals with it, deals with traditional architecture, instead of being hoity-toity about everything, they will never, in fact, have the effect they want to have. They'll always be dealing only with the clients, and they'll miss the 2 million other houses that are being built in this country. And
well,
I hope the editor's here.
One of the things that I was very aware of when I went to a conference recently about the future of housing, and it was mostly architects that were there, was that a lot of us as a profession are really excited about the possibility of, you know, a new type of house. But like the image that I was showing about that house of the future, it's always looking at the avant-garde. It's always focusing on, you know, a brave new world. And that key, it's so key that we have to be able to meet the middle class.
Actually,
we have to be able to get them to
There's one
understand.
Thing about modernist architecture. Yeah. If the architects agreed, at least regionally, what modernist architecture has, was the people would begin to understand it. Because what happens is no sooner, for example, I can take Joe what's it called, lunch bucket, whatever, Joe Sixpack, and explain to them a modern building. In fact, I have taken a series of regular folk to see Cranbrook, to see a building like by Steve Hall, which they disliked on sight. I explained every bit of it, and they got it. They got it, they understood it, they said, pretty cool, right? Then we walked down the street on the campus to a building by one of the other hotshot architects, I forget. Anyway, the one who's married to a Chinese wife. What?
Todd Williams.
Todd Williams. So after I had trained them, right, for Steve Hall, and they got it, they went to Todd Williams and said, well, what the hell is this? And what happens is that architects, in fact, will not even agree as to what modernist architecture is, even regionally, so you never allow the common folk to become experts and to develop a taste
for
it. They continually undermine each other with this uniqueness.
Right.
The only place this is happening a little bit is in Austin, Texas. Yeah.
The only thing that's fascinating about this issue is that it's uniqueness that's the focus, and it isn't unique because we're all doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a missing there, and this is where
uniqueness in unison.
Really being able to, yeah, that's right. It's a big fashion show, and we really need to start looking at what
makes people. Standardized originality. That's pathetic.
What inspires people, and then how do you create buildings that are truly beautiful and inspiring? And that's when we're really going to get it. And I know that in California, Sim Vanderin is here in the audience, and he did a tremendous service to this state in just understanding that and bringing into your government buildings places that are extraordinary by any stretch of the imagination anywhere else in the country. So it's there, the idea's there, but it's so important that we as a profession really understand the role that we need to play in bringing
in
that
one
forward.
Of the 5 years of architecture school, the students should clearly work for customers. They should work for the American middle class. It would have such a beneficial effect. Like I go to builders, big builders, people who build 50,000 houses, 10,000 houses a year. And you know who's drafting for them in the back room? Some guy that went to technical high school. And they're actually doing, 5,000 houses a year. There are restaurants in San Francisco, interiors, that have more design than entire square miles of suburbia. And the kids in the schools are actually taught that that's cool and that you, in fact, should actually stay completely away from the new urbanists and anything that deals with the middle class. It's actually unethical. These exciting kids, these excited kids that want to deal with the real problems, and you train them, in fact, away from the real problems of our society.
Right.
By saying anybody who does a pitch roof is ipso facto a problem. Well, you know what happens? What happens when you actually tell a kid that it's unethical? Can you do anything so ridiculous that you actually teach a kid that a double pitch roof is unethical? That it's out of this. You know what? You completely disempower that kid from ever relating to the American middle class.
Yeah.
Just cut them off.
One of the things that I used to say, I was criticized for really what our profession thinks of as unethical behavior for talking about the possibility of making architecturally designed homes available in plants. And I stood up and said, I believe it's unethical for architects to look at what's happening in suburbia, turn our noses in the air, and walk in the other direction. We're the only people that can do something.
Well, there's no problem bypassing the architects. I mean, absolutely no problem. we retain 200 designers a year. We're doing over 20 new towns a year. And bypassing the architects of profession is like no problem.
Right.
They are so marginalized. It's really quite extraordinary.
And we've done it to ourselves.
They've cornered themselves into just a kind of aesthetic manifestation of the zeitgeist and some kind of aestheticizing of the environmental. But they're completely missing the boat. And all the schools but three are totally missing the boat.
Yeah.
200 architecture schools. And they're not enough. Our clients beg for architects that won't reduce the value of their designs. Reduce the value. You bring an architect in, causes nothing but trouble and causes nothing but disconnection with the market. They can't believe it. They don't know what's going on with the architecture schools.
Yeah. I have somebody here in the front row, this guy.
Hi, this question's for Andres. You've been talking about new suburban areas you're doing. I didn't see it on any of your slides, by the way, but are you giving up on existing suburban, or do you have something going on to try to, you know, okay, resurrect the mistakes of the suburban?
Well, that's another very long presentation. But you see, there's the designs that are actually models, you know, for different things. And actually, every one of our designs attempts to actually take a different, as my brother says, he says, you're deploying projects like regiments, taking territory. And we actually, now we have a fully modernist project that's almost finished. We have an avant-gardist project. We have green projects. We actually try to get each one of the projects to become an exemplar of something, of these communities. Now, the reason you haven't heard about them is that they take a decade to build, because many, many designers are involved. But what we're actually doing, because we have the problem of large numbers in the United States, 60 million new Americans, is what really matters are the codes. The reason there isn't more new urbanism, when a third of the population would clearly choose it, and possibly two-thirds in some areas, is that it's an uphill battle, in fact, to get it permitted. So now what we've been doing, what I've been dedicated intellectually to, is writing comprehensive ordinances that become model ordinances, and which are now freely available throughout this country. Because an ordinance is a very expensive thing. And if you want one of these ordinances, the latest model, a completely comprehensive that integrates environmentalism, is called a smart code. And it's becoming a model ordinance in several states. It's actually, I think it's going to become acceptable in California. It's a form-based ordinance. And that is really where the genetic material is being created, is the codes. The codes is where the power lies. What?
Is it free?
Yes, it's free. It used to be $10,000, which we did for several years to establish its extraordinary value. And then as soon as it took off, we made it free. So now.
Last row.
Smart code, one word.
In 5 or 15 minutes, we will go our separate ways. Before we do that, first I want to thank the people who put this together, because this has been not an ordinary talk. But I'd like, my question is for you to pose the question. My question to you is, ultimately, there's some kernel of wisdom. There's some way of approaching something that cuts through a great deal of that stuff. And we do have more stuff than brains these days. How to summarize this? Observation. This is halfway through a monumental environmental week in a major city in the United States, where across from this building by three blocks, you have the largest meeting of builders and developers on the West Coast.
Right.
Not a clue by the vice president of one of the major associations about the kind of stuff that Jim teaches on a weekly basis. Not a clue. But they're putting out 100,000, 200 million homes a year. You walk through the trade show part, and it's not green material a little bit. It's $500 doors.
Yeah.
What's the question that we should be able to walk away from and ask ourselves to be smarter? Because ultimately, there's something that cuts through. Thich Nhat Hanh said, happiness is available. Help yourself.
There was a green movement, absolutely heroic, in which Sim Van Der Rim was involved in the 70s. People like Doug Kelbel, people like Peter Calthorpe, absolutely heroic environmental movement, actually very advanced. The problem is that there was a Calvinist take to it. You know, you had to, in fact, the aesthetic that was involved, if you touched it, for example, if you touched the handrail, it gave you a splinter. Or you had to live with your own compost. You know, there was that kind of slightly troglodytic attitude towards the first. And it became associated with, in fact, a Calvinist, you must suffer to live environmentally. There's a new movement now that, in fact, presents it as the pleasure of an opening window and a breeze, the pleasure of walking. Yes, you can have a car, but the pleasure of walking to your daily needs. You know, the pleasure of a clean interior environment that actually smells great. The pleasure of sunlight instead of and I think the whole presentation of environmentalism now is going to succeed because it is so aesthetic. The new environmental houses are really gorgeous. And in fact, I think that what is going to transcend the impasse and the crisis of traditional architecture, and we've already done it, we have projects working this way, is that actually the way we're going to get past the nostalgia is by saying this is a green building, and that's what a green building looks like. And people will salute and say, well, if that's what a green building looks like, then I love it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the coming aesthetic is, in fact, if the green architects continue developing aesthetic, and it doesn't just become just one more aesthetic, you know, and if they actually continue presenting the pleasure and the beauty of living in such buildings, environmentalism will, in fact, succeed this time around.
And I just want to add one thing, and that is that we all see all these problems as out there. And if you start living what you know and speaking what you know, it does change. I mean, when I wrote The Not-So-Big House, I couldn't in my wildest dreams have imagined what's happened. I'm sure, Andres, you've had the same experience. All I did, I was just an architect doing houses, but I knew some stuff. And by speaking it in the medium that I was conversant with, which was writing, everything shifts. And so the message to all of you, if you just stop for a second and realize how much creativity and capability and possibility is sitting in this room, you know who you are and you know what you can do, and all we have to do is do it. But instead of it being the negative, you know, no, 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 if we can start to say yes, 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 it'll change it completely.
The thing is, we're here, what we're witnessing here, like the acceptance of Susan's work in the new urbanism, has to do with the incredible capacity of this society to reform itself. And you have to be an outsider to see how unique that is. And actually what's happening is that we've tried every possible thing and it hasn't worked. And Churchill put it beautifully. When the United States actually finally entered the Second World War, they say, Churchill said, you can count on Americans to do the right thing after they have tried every possible alternative. And that's where we're at now. We've tried every possible alternative. And finally, I think we're set up, you know, for a generation of doing the right thing. I mean, everywhere you feel it. The builders, too.
Yeah.
The builders are ready to do the right thing. We went to a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous meeting today for builders at lunch. And it was just, what can we do to do the right thing? It was amazing.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, but they won't do it without the architects. If the architects are too good for the builders, if the architects are too good for the American middle class, the builders aren't going to get there.
Right.
They're just not going to get there. The architecture profession has to swallow hard and engage the reality of the United States.
And collaborate.
Okay,
two questions, and I think they're already spoken for questions because we have some special guests here.
Oh, is that me? quick question for you, Andres. Underlying your whole presentation was the obvious necessity of building coalitions between environmental groups, the new urbanists, whatever, the green builders, whatever you want to call it. I'm wondering if you had any success stories of building those coalitions and what unique attributes or factors of that project you attribute to that success.
Yes, there are. Well, the project proceeds. We have a project, by the way, because it is more expensive to build green, don't let anybody tell you it isn't. Okay, we need to pioneer with higher end projects. And every once in a while we get a project that comes our way that is actually unconscionably well funded for very high end. By the way, modernist architects like Richard Meyer and everybody else have no trouble doing that. They get away with it because they have this Russian revolutionary aesthetic, and everybody forgets that in fact it's for very conventional people living in big houses in the country. But the fact is that when we do find a project that's well funded, we go for it. And we have one that is called Alice Beach, which is a resort. And resorts are very interesting experimental platforms because people in their vacations are willing to live a more utopian existence. In fact, that's part of it. You wouldn't go somewhere and pay so much money to live the way you do daily. So whenever a resort comes our way, we don't say, well, this is a dead end, unethical. We say, this is an experimental platform. And we have a resort called Alice Beach that is experimenting environmentally and in various other very radical ways, none of which are aesthetic, by the way. Okay? The only thing that's aesthetic about it is that every single surface, roof, wall, everything is white, which apparently is the single biggest thing you can do for energy in the hotter states. That's the number one thing you can do. So we said, if that's it, white, very elegant. No problem with that. But it's not experimental in any way that will keep anybody away, but it is very advanced environmentally. And now, as soon as we build two houses, the EPA and everybody else is on it. Two houses out of what's going to be over 1,000, and it's already, they're parading through it and actually taking ownership of it as an example of how to do things well. So I think the way to do it, at least, see, the new urbanist way is private sector initiative. Now, if you want to sort of, and I believe that the smart growth people, you know, are doing their job doing it policy, but if you ask me what would I do, I would say private sector initiative. Let the developers do it right, and let the developers prove that people will pay handsomely for it, and then let government follow and give us awards, if they wish.
First, Mark Palmer, the last question.
Yes. I am actually one of the mayors attending this conference as a delegate from... And I'm actually the mayor of a village and not a city. I'm a mayor of a village called New Paltz, about an hour and a half north of Manhattan.
Right.
So I'd like to thank you both for one of the best presentations I've had in my 2 days here. And I wish that the rest of the conference was as intelligent and articulate and comprehensive as this presentation has been. I tell you, the conversation in the meeting rooms is not nearly on the caliber we've had here tonight. My question, because Mr. Duane, you said correctly that we politicians like to keep things simple, my question is a simple one, and that is, given that I'm the mayor of a village of just 6,000 people, is there a scale at which new urbanism and your ideas work or don't work? Is there a certain size that matters?
Apparently not, actually. The model of, there are models at every scale that, in fact, are sustainable. The hamlet, they're all traditional. The hamlet, the village, the town, and the city made of neighborhoods. And by the way, they have different neologisms that may confuse you. The hamlet is actually cluster design. You know, the village is called a TND, traditional neighborhood development. The town is called a regional center, which is Calthrop's terminology, is a regional center. And then there is, of course, the neighborhoods of the core. And when you look at actually the fact that technically a generation of planners has arrived at all these quote-unquote solutions that happen to coincide exactly with traditional patterns, that gives a fantastic confirmation when actually you've actually gone through the entire, you know, the long march and arrived at the beginning to actually the confirmation. And once you see it through the technical eyes that you've developed yourself, you can actually identify the absolute wisdom of you know, 5,000 years of building. And by the way, cross-culturally, you know, I've been to Beijing, and I've been to, you know, I've been to all sorts of places. And it's, I mean, to Pompeii, you know, 2,000 years ago, you walk into Pompeii, and you can, and within a couple of minutes, you know, where the shops are, where the civic centers are, what's a house, you know, where you do sports, readily identifiable. Now, I go to one of these inventions by some of the avant-garde architects, particularly of California, and I need to be completely reoriented. And I have an advanced degree in architecture. And I can read a plan, you know? And so you find that you get this confirmation that's perennial. You know, as humans have always, and I find that the avant-gardism of the profession, it bothers and worries me not at all because it's a dead end. And it's a lot of fun for a lot of people. And as soon we've hit peak oil already, we don't have to wait, by the way, for global warming to knock out that all, you know, all those fun and games. It's just going to be peak oil, and we're there already.
Mm-hmm. I reserve the prerogative of asking the last question. Would you both come back and talk to us again sometime in San Francisco?